Father, in the name of Jesus, we ask you to confirm this word tonight with signs following, even the video. Let the power of God go into this video, and as people watch it, let them be healed and prove that you are behind what is being spoken. Stand behind your word and honor us tonight, our Father. Heal, deliver, and bless the people. Fill them with your spirit. Save them in Jesus' mighty name. Amen.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the VCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 29th of April, 2022. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with military psychological warfare, Ukraine propaganda, or whatever else propaganda might be coming our way. Instead, navigating us calmly, for the most part, through the Fourth Reich, the Matrix, or whatever it is, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. Really looking forward to this great reset, guys, you know, where we have no property, but we're still happy, on pills, probably. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also joining us is former Bristol City Councillor, Labour Councillor, that's Estella Ticknell. Part one, we'll be looking at, we'll be asking Estella about her film preferences. She's a film lecturer at University of the West of England, I think. I am still,
just come from there.
And also about the crossing and uncrossing of Angela Rayner's legs and whether it actually is worthy of a news story. And we've got a clean air zone coming here in Bristol at some point, we're not quite sure when. A big controversy that's been raging around the tobacco factory and a production company called The Egg. It's called The Family Sex Show, which advertised itself as naked performers in front of children as young as five. Now, is this the right sort of thing to be doing in a theatre? Also, we speak to Robert Hansen, who's now here, back from Hong Kong. He's now living in the UK for the last 6 weeks or so. His opinions on the China lockdowns that have been happening over the last few weeks, and also the way that the British actually made things far worse for people in Hong Kong by encouraging these mass million people protests on the streets over there. In part two, we'll be looking at Ukraine, obviously. The usual, I mean, almost every week we seem to have at least a clip from Scott Ritter. This isn't an exclusive interview with him this week, but a fascinating one nevertheless, where he looks at the Ukrainian Nazis. It's a very strange anomaly at the heart of this war, that is that you've got the first Jewish president in charge of Ukraine, and yet thousands of real Nazi soldiers. They're not neo-Nazis, these guys. They are real supporters of Hitler. They use these Hitler symbols, etc. And also an exclusive with Alex Craner. Alex is also looking at the similar subject, which is who are these Ukrainian Nazis? And also the possibility of a much wider war, of Ukraine turning into a third world war. We finish up part two by looking at Green Fascism. It's a guy that's written a book on the Nazi environmentalists that he's rather concerned about. Anyway, we're joined by Estella Ticknell. Estella, you were a councillor for, I think you were just saying, 6, 7 years.
8 years.
8 years, yeah. Crikey, okay. Shows about my attention to detail, doesn't it? But you stepped down last year as a Labour councillor.
Yeah, stepped down in May last year.
Why did you step down? Is it anything to do with not being happy with the Labour Party, or is it just burnout?
It was partly burnout, because I still got a full-time job, and I was holding on to a full-time job as well as being a councillor, and for a while cabinet member and deputy mayor. And it is exhausting doing all of that. And being a councillor, a lot of what the public see generally, what happens in the council house, is actually the tip of the iceberg, because most of what you do is dealing with constituents and your ward, going to ward meetings in the evenings very often. So I'd often go from Uwe, where I work, straight over to Lockleys. So I'd leave Uwe at 6:30, get to Lockleys for 7, be there till 9:30, go home, go back to work the next day. And that is very tiring, you know. And much as I love Lockleys, and I still have a lot of fondness for the place, and I keep a weather eye on what's going on there, I'm so glad that we did some good stuff, including getting a new school built there, for example. But it got to the point I was thinking, God, I'm getting really tired, you know, keeping all the balls rolling. So it was nothing to do with the Labour Party and everything to do with just thinking, let someone else have a go.
Well, the reason you're here is because we've got quite an important event next week here. We haven't got local elections here in Bristol, but what we have got is something that the Liberal Democrats have fought for several several years to get, which is another chance to vote on whether we think the mayor system is a good system or not. Before you give us your view, which way do you think is it going to go?
Well, I think it could go either way, actually. I mean, we've been out doing a bit of campaigning in Bristol West, and as far as I can tell from that, people are moving towards retaining the mayoral system. But I know, having talked to Martin, and I know that a lot of other people are saying, oh, we don't want any more of this, let's go to the committee system. So it seems to me to be neck and neck.
I mean, you haven't experienced both as a councillor, have you? Because you've been there whilst the mayor's been there all the way through, surely.
Yeah, no, that's true. Although my partner was a councillor, actually, in Birmingham, and I've always been actively involved in politics, so I do know a little bit about the committee system.
Do you want to tell us what's the difference between having a mayor and committees? Because it does look, on the surface of it, it's more democratic. You've got, you know, scores and scores of councillors making decisions with all sorts of views being fed in, rather than just one mayor.
Well, I think one of the things is that the mayor is, don't forget, democratically elected by the whole city. Whereas if you have a leader of the council, they're only elected by their own party, and that person might change from year to year depending on the mood of the party.
But hang on, because Marvin is nominated by his party, not by the people of Bristol.
No, that's true, but he's up against other party candidates, and indeed, you know, we had an independent, of course, with George Ferguson in the past. So it seems to me that you're talking about democracy, then it's actually a much more directly democratic system, and if people don't like the mayor, they can vote him out. And the people of Bristol actually re-elected Marvin last year, so there must be some people quite happy with what he's doing so far.
So it sounds to me like you're leaning towards the keeping the mayor system. But look, before we get into that, let's hear a little bit more about you and your job up at the University of the West of England.
Well, I teach film studies. I've just actually taught my third years up there for the last time today. We watched a film called Baby Driver, which is a fantastic...
Sounds like a good course. You sit and watch a film.
Yeah, I know. That's what we were only talking about that. People say, oh, you teach film studies, you sit around watching films all day. Slightly more complicated than that. My students are going to have to go away and write a critical case study comparing the way in which music works in at least two films. And I've been doing stuff on the biopic, for example, you know, the biographical music film, the rockumentary. We've been thinking about the way in which the score works in films to underscore feeling, evoke certain meanings. So it's not quite as simple as just sitting around watching films, but of course it's enjoyable.
Martin, have you got any beefs about films you'd like to put to Estella about modern film? Or,
well, I like films.
That's an inane comment.
And I haven't really got much more to add.
What was the last film you went to the cinema to see?
Actually, I went on Sunday, and it was not the sort of film I would normally go and see, but I thought I'm going to go to the cinema this evening because it was work the next day, and I couldn't think of anything else to do with myself, and it was called Northman.
It
was actually dire. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Well, this is my beef, Estella, is films now are dire. I tend to download films to watch these days, mostly from the 40s, 50s and 60s.
Mm.
And I don't really watch hardly anything that's on. I did watch the Dreyfus film. I don't know if you've managed to see that.
No,
yet,
I haven't seen
because,
that.
It's not easy to see. This is the Polanski-Dreyfus film, which is very...
Okay.
Very controversial, because he's controversial. But
this is about the Dreyfus Affair, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's a terrific film. He's Jewish himself, and so obviously he really does understand, you know, helps him understand the issues in this. Actually, it was our sound engineer, Dave, here, who helped us get the English subtitles.
Oh, really?
And weave them into the MP4. You can have it in French with no subtitles, but that's no good. You need some English subtitles. So Dave managed to do that. I didn't see that in the cinema, no. But, you know, just the general quality of film is right down. And we interviewed David Wicks on this before this programme a few months ago. He's an ex-Euston Films guy. He used to work... I'm trying to think. It was The Sweeney. That's right. He directed several episodes of The Sweeney. He's absolutely damning about modern filmmaking.
Really?
And he went over to the States to try and make a film. And he said they were just messing me about the whole time, trying to get me sacked so they could get one of their mates to take over as director. I mean, these sorts of stories about Hollywood and filmmaking, there's a lot of egos in there.
And of course, it
seems to me as if egos have sort of, you know, pushed out the real creatives.
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. My special area is music and film, as I said, but also British cinema. So, I wouldn't disagree if you're going to say that Marvel dominates contemporary popular cinema too much. I would agree. I think it's really problematic, actually, the extent to which franchises are completely taking over our screens. But there are still some good films being made and some good British films. And interestingly, I'm Talking Pictures TV is a fantastic channel.
Well, we love that too.
Am I allowed to do a plug for that?
You definitely are. Yeah, I mean, it's about the only thing worth watching on Freeview. In fact, a lot of parts of the country that can't pick up Talking Pictures, people are sort of trying to alter their aerials to pick up the nearby a city where you can pick Talking Pictures up.
So I love Talking Pictures, but, you know, if you watch Talking Pictures on a regular basis, you will see there are some excellent older films. There's some pretty dross. Yeah, you know, there's some pretty bad stuff as well. So the idea that we're only getting bad films now is clearly not true. So the film I most recently went to see at the cinema was Operation Mincemeat, which is a British film. Very interesting. It's a bit of a remake, actually, of a film made in the late 50s called The Man It Never Was, which is all about the British effectively duping the Germans during the war in 1943 into believing that an invasion was going to take place in one place when actually it was planned somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yes. And so they basically picked up a tramp who died very sadly and invented a backstory for him. He was taken out to sea in a submarine and floated off the Spanish coast, complete with a whole range of documents which supposedly validated him as a real person. So he was invented as a naval commander, and he carried with him supposedly secret papers. And the backstory they invented, including letters and a photograph from a supposed girlfriend, was so convincing and persuasive that the Germans were actually persuaded to shift their focus so that they actually believed they'd really found secret papers. So it was a very effective operation.
I wonder, though, with all these remakes, was it better than the original?
That's a good question. In the original, interestingly, Martin, they added in a backstory about the IRA, which is completely spurious. Now, this one was more accurate, and it was based on a memoir by Montague, one of the people involved. But, for example, we had Ian Fleming there, who, of course, as you probably know, generally worked for MI6, but I don't know that he was definitely involved in this particular
naval
operation.
Naval intelligence, he was.
That's right. Well, of course, this was naval intelligence involved in this. And they also added in a somewhat specious love story, which in many ways was unnecessary. And you also had Colin Firth magnificently suffering with a stiff upper lip, you know, all the way through. Because you do know that during the Second World War, everyone spoke with a posh accent, and it was entirely won by the upper classes.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, of course, and not the Russians. Absolutely. Don't you dare say that.
The Ruskies, no.
Anyway, it sounds like you're giving it a pretty good review. What makes for a good filmmaker, a good director, a good producer? What makes a good film?
God, yes, but that's a really difficult question, is it? Because my idea of a good film isn't necessarily exactly the same as
it's got to be something. No, I know, but it's got to be something that draws you in, that makes you think, crikey, what's going to happen next? You know, how does a filmmaker do that?
Well,
what makes a good, you know, and maybe you could possibly
tension,
just name
conflict.
Some of your favourite films and then we can get an idea.
But, well, I mean, I have a whole range of favourite films. I mean, for example, another film I've been writing about recently is The Power of the Dog, which is Jane Campion's most recent film. And I've written about Campion's work in the past. That's a very, very different film. It's ostensibly a Western set in
Montana. So an American film?
No. Campion is herself a New Zealand film director.
Oh, okay.
She came to fame with The Piano in 1993, which is really a woman-centred narrative. So she specialises in kind of psychological dramas. And The Power of the Dog is based on a novel which is published in the 1960s, which is about the tensions between two brothers and the wife of one of the brothers and the son of one of the brothers. And it's basically a kind of psychological thriller, and it's set in the Old West in the 1920s. Very contentious because she was criticised for making a Western. How dare a woman make a Western? How dare she claim to know about these things, you know? But it won an Oscar. So, I mean, and it's actually been very successful. And interestingly, distributed on Netflix. So, you know, an interesting way of getting films to people.
So what's happening with Netflix? They seem to be sort of topping out.
I know. Well, obviously, I guess the cost of living crisis in the UK has affected that to some extent, that people aren't prepared to pay extra anymore. We just received a thing the other day on our Netflix service saying, are you prepared to pay £5 more? And we said, reluctantly, OK, we will for the time being, you know. But I think that, yes, Netflix is plateauing, isn't it? I think that's one of the issues we're finding. It was growing enormously over the last few years and rivaling the kind of the old distributors. And Netflix and Amazon, of course, are global conglomerates over which we have very little power. So it's good, I think, that they are finding themselves challenged, you know, because
what worries me is why is it that Netflix has to make a documentary about Jimmy Savile and all the politics that goes with that, and ITV, BBC, Channel 4 don't? it's the main reason is they're just worried about legal stuff. But Savile's dead. You know, it's also, there's politics involved in all this, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And I guess the BBC is too shamefaced to make such a thing. I haven't watched it myself, and I'm not sure I want to watch it. And I know everyone will say this now, but speaking as a woman who was a teenager when Savile was famous, I always found him creepy. But like everybody else, I assumed that perhaps I was the only one who felt that. You know, he seemed like a creep to me when he presented Top of the Pops. And I don't think any teenage girl would have found him remotely attractive. But it's somehow there was a kind of conspiracy of silence about that.
Oh God,
wasn't
and it carried on after he died as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I worked with a woman called Liz McKean, and
she was at
Newsnight and was about to expose Savile after his death.
Yes,
and was told no. You're not allowed to do that. We've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas.
That's right.
No chance. And so all of the potential legal reasons why they didn't want to have a Savile expose would go on.
But you'd also got to a point where every member of the establishment had persuaded themselves that he was a good guy, effectively, hadn't they? You know.
Well, yes, persuaded themselves. Yeah. Well, the other thing, of course, is that Netflix documentary, as we were discussing here a few weeks ago, it comes up with some incredible stuff about how Savile really was a special advisor to Prince Charles.
Yes.
And he was writing the policy for security for the royal family. I mean, what you've got here is, you know, what is going on at the top in power politics is pretty scary, pretty frightening. How something like that can be allowed to happen is shocking. Anyway, look, talking about power, back to the mayoral elections, Estella. And are you pro keeping the mayor? Why?
Well, actually, let me just say that I think this referendum is an expensive distraction. Something like £600,000 is being spent on this, which could have been spent on other things. For me, we've only had a mayor.
The council itself voted for it, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Well, I'm sorry, I think they were wrong to do so. Yeah. And as you know, it's the Liberal Democrats who are pushing this. And I'll tell you why. We have a history of local government which goes back at least 150 years. We've just had 10 years of a mayoral system. And that's 10 years in which we've had extremes of Tory austerity. We've had a pandemic. We've had umpteen other major crises, which the council has had to deal with. And it seems to me that it's too soon to say the system doesn't work. Are we going to have another referendum in 10 years' time and switch back to the mayoral system? 10 years ago, the people of Bristol voted and said they wanted a mayor. Now, at the time, I was in two minds about it, actually. I didn't necessarily endorse the mayoral system. And my reasons for saying ultimately now I think we need to stick with what we got are not just because I was a deputy mayor.
There's a few bob in that, isn't there?
Well, actually, no, to be honest.
Really?
To be honest,
I think you get an increase as a councillor if you're in the cabinet.
Yes,
or
you do.
Mayor,
you do. But, I mean, don't forget, I was already on quite a good salary as a you know, I didn't make very much money out of being a councillor, I can tell you. I actually lost money from paying a lot more tax, which I was happy to do. Mm. But when people say, oh, you're just in it for the money, most councillors get an allowance of, what, £13,000, which isn't very much to live on. Mm. And that's one problem. Anyway, set that aside. So my concern is that one of the things that became clear was that the recognition level of mayors is much greater than it is for leaders of the council. Now, I understand from Robin Hambleton, who is actually a UE colleague and was with me at a debate about this the other night within the Labour Party, was saying that the levels of recognition of Marvin as the leader of the city is something like 52%. Now, 10 years ago, only less than 20% of people living in Bristol could name the leader of the council
who they were. Isn't that down to the press? The press decide who we recognise, don't they? They're not really that interested in Bristol as a city where they've got a figurehead in charge, but they seem to with a mayor. Why is that?
Well, I dare say the press is in favour of mayoral
system. Maybe they prefer it when there's only one phone number to call up.
Probably, but maybe ordinary people prefer that too, and they've got a clear sense of who's in charge of a city. And I think with a committee system, what you're going to find, firstly, there'll be a lack of clarity over how and where decisions are made. And whatever you think of the mayor, and if this isn't about Marvin, because he's not going to be standing again, whatever you think of our mayor, it's very clear the buck stops with him. And I think that was especially important during the pandemic, when hard decisions had to be made about what needs to be done to deal with it.
Well,
now, with a committee, I think that's less likely.
He's inaccessible, and he's his committees he's set up, his One City, I think it's called, committees, they are basically handpicked by him to make policy.
Well, actually, that's not true. You've got the One City group, okay, which is basically a group of people coming together from business, local industry, the trade unions as well, are part of that grouping. And their job is to develop ideas. But what they do not do is make policy. Policy is made by politicians, not by the One City
by
group.
By the mayor.
Well, actually, when I was a cabinet member, it wasn't just made by the mayor, because he devolved those powers to us as cabinet members. Of course, he would have the final veto, but we were given the freedom to discuss with officers, quite rightly, and develop policy with our officers.
Why was it that Bristol decided it wanted a mayor, but most other cities that were given the chance back 8 years ago or whatever it was said, no, we don't want this?
I think it's because Bristol had a long history going back about 30 years of indecision and muddle and lack of clarity and not much happening in this city. And one of the things I'm very pleased about is we're starting to build houses. We've got a housing crisis in Bristol. We've got gentrification, which is pushing ordinary people out of the housing market. And we haven't got enough social and council housing. And Marvin has made a clear decision that that was his top priority, and he's starting to build those houses. And I happen to think that under a committee system, that would have been watered down, because you would have had opposition politicians saying, oh, well, not in my backyard. Well, no, I don't think that's a good idea.
Here in Bristol, one of the big problems is, well, say problems, but a lot of people are rather annoyed about the way that the arena has been taken away from Templemead Station, that area, and stuck up in South Gloucestershire, yeah, or Clifton.
Yeah.
Not Clifton. Yeah, Filton. Well, that would be an interesting
that
idea.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? That would happen in Clifton,
on the
wouldn't
downs,
it?
Maybe. But anyway, no. But
that was a pragmatic decision. At the end of the day, that Arena Island site was actually costing a lot of money before anything happened to it, because the site itself was not really that suitable. It seems to me Marvin made a sensible decision, which is, do we want to spend lots of public money at a time when we're being cut to the bone, or do we actually do a deal and ensure we deliver the arena? It may not be an ideal site, but that's for complex reasons to do with transport systems, which Marvin doesn't have direct control over. And I hear what you're saying, but these are complicated decisions.
People want to be able to either get the train, the bus, or walk there. Filton is way out of town.
Well, it is. Well, it's out of town, but it's still a regional centre, isn't it?
You can actually access it. How long does it take to walk there? I mean, or cycle as well. I mean, it depends how strong you are as a cyclist. Anyway, I found it quite interesting that the previous mayor to Marvin, George Ferguson, has come out quite strongly against the idea of continuing with the mayor. It's interesting that he was the first person to be elected as a mayor, as an independent, although he was a member of the Lib Dems.
He was indeed, yeah.
He then sort of went independent. He's an architect, former president of the Royal Institute for British Architects, a merchant venturer,
yeah.
Also, who are this kind of elite group that have
indeed
been around doing, discovering North America, killing off Native Americans and doing slave trading and things
like
that.
I'm not sure you can blame George Ferguson for that, directly.
Well, we can't, no, but he was brought into that group, I think, Estella. It would be interesting to know what you think. I think because they felt it was better to have him on the inside rather than the outside, because he was a vociferous campaigner back in the sort of 70s and 80s against bad development as an architect.
Yes.
He was saying, well, look, you can't build these massive boxes up into the sky. It looks horrible. It looks ugly. We've got to look after our city.
No, I agree. And I think George Ferguson did some good things, actually, when he was doing that kind of development. And I think that he tried hard as mayor. And he did do some good stuff. I mean, I think the 20-mile zone was a good thing, actually. I know a lot of people didn't like it. But I think we probably all accept now that's probably a sensible decision.
Well, let me know you into a secret. I was driving along the other day, around about 2025, and I was overtaken by a police car. I don't think the police take the 20 mile an hour limit really seriously.
Well, they should.
It wasn't on the blues and twos. He was just cruising past. I thought, well, 30 miles an hour, they seem to think, is the limit.
I know it was a controversial decision, and at the time a lot of people were saying, well, that's disgraceful, you know. I think it's probably got to the point now that we recognise that, especially in built-up areas, a 20 mile zone is probably a good thing. But what I would say to you, for George, apart from that, I don't think he did very much. He was very keen on kind of public relations and appearing in public, but making tough decisions about the way in which the city was run was something he didn't do. And let's not forget, there was an enormous deficit when Labour came to power, because the wool had been pulled over his eyes on the amount of money that was actually being spent
in
Bristol.
I mean, he would say he was trying to be creative with the city accounts to try and keep services going as much as possible. And of course, when Marvin came in, even though, of course, he's a Labour mayor, there were a lot more cuts than there'd been under George, because he was having to be more realistic with the finances, not using reserves, not juggling figures and that sort of thing.
Creative accounting is not a good way forward, is it? Because you'll eventually have to deal with that. And that's exactly the problem that we were faced with. So we were told there was a certain amount of money, and actually it turned out there wasn't.
Well, people get a bit annoyed paying their council tax, don't they, when they can't even use a public toilet anymore.
Yes, but the thing is, what people often don't realise is that most money for local authorities does not come from council tax. It comes from the national grant. And the Tory government, since 2010, has systematically, year on year, cut its grant to local authorities by nearly 70%. Now, this is George Osborne's plan. So it started in 2010. Now, to then continue with exactly the same services is really challenging. And one of the biggest challenges...
Well, it's impossible.
It's impossible. And one of the biggest challenges local government faces is that at the moment most of local council revenue money, not capital money, so there is a separation in the budget, as you probably know, most revenue money goes on social care. And that's because we have an ageing population who quite rightly are entitled to support and care in their own homes or in older people's homes, but it's costing a fortune. And yet, at the same time, councils are being asked to run exactly the same services we might have expected, rightly, 20
years ago.
But
funnily enough, we've got loads of money to buy tanks and anti-aircraft, shoulder-held doobries, whatever they are, for Ukraine. Well, but we can't keep the public toilets open.
That's a political decision made by national government, isn't it, about how they spend their money.
Anyway, let's have a listen to George Ferguson now, the former mayor of Bristol, independent, what he has to say to me today, earlier on, about why he thinks it's time for the mayor system to go.
I'm George Ferguson. I'm the previous elected mayor of Bristol from 2012-2016. And it may seem strange that I'm opposed to continuation of the city mayor role, because we've had some real game changers since 2012. I would have stood for the Metro Mayor position if that had existed then. And the Metro Mayor position, to my mind, makes the Bristol Mayor position redundant. And worse than that, the Bristol Mayor role is now pretty dysfunctional, as is the city region, the West of England. The Metro Mayor is being undermined all the time by the city mayor. So that's one real game changer. And we are so disadvantaged compared with many other cities, the cities to the north, Manchester with Andy Burnham, such as Birmingham with Andy Street, both from different parties, but both recognised as being the champions of those areas. And the other game changers is that when I was mayor, we introduced all-out four-year elections. And because there's been arguments that a committee system, which is undoubtedly more democratic, is nevertheless less stable. And that was true to a certain extent when we had annual elections by thirds across the council. People didn't know when the elections were, and it resulted in a lot of chopping and changing. Now we have all-out four-yearly elections. That gets rid of that criticism about instability. Another game change is that we now have a party mayor who is not really elected by the people of Bristol. The party mayor is selected in a process that is completely invisible to the people of Bristol, and then is elected on the back of that party. And so the argument that you've got this directly elected mayor is directly answerable to the people of Bristol is untrue. That directly elected mayor is directly answerable to the National Labour Party, who provide his office to a certain extent.
Yeah, but you, as an independent, an independent can stand like you did and run against a party mayor.
Absolutely, but I mean, you can only do that once. I mean, my view is that I took them by surprise, and they didn't for a moment believe I could win, and I only half believed I could. But I went hell for leather for it. You can't do that twice, because the power of a national party in local politics is enormous in terms of their resource, the funds, the leafleting and all that sort of thing. And so in retrospect, it was damn near impossible to win in a major city. I was the only independent in any major city in the UK, and I think possibly will be the only independent in the foreseeable future of any major city in the UK, because the parties are so strong and dominant. And the other game changer, and part of that party thing is, so we now have a mayor with a all one-party cabinet, which is against the promise that we would have a rainbow cabinet that more represented the will of the people and the makeup of the council. But the fourth game changer is that Bristol has spilled well beyond its official boundary, so that a quarter of Bristol, at least, possibly a third of the area of Bristol is now, of urban Bristol, is now in South Gloucestershire, and a bit in North Somerset, which incidentally the Bristol mayor has kept out of the combined authority, again for party political reasons, but it makes no sense to leave North Somerset out of the governance of the combined authority. And so there are all sorts of reasons why we should now invest our future in the combined authority, which is a very different sort of mayor. Directly elected, yes, but that mayor has a cabinet that's made up of the four leaders of the surrounding districts, and that gives a safety valve that we don't have in Bristol.
So that's former mayor George Ferguson, also ex-president of the Royal Institute for British Architects. He was fairly successful in selling this idea of having a mayor, but it's interesting and intriguing that he's now said, well, even though I was mayor myself, I think it's a bad idea.
Yeah, it sounds like he's rejoining Lib Dems to me. That's the argument he's making. It's a very familiar one. And special pleading as well. You know, oh dear, I couldn't fight against it, so I decided to stand down. But he did stand against Melbourne and he lost. So, you know, that's nonsensical as far as I'm concerned.
What about those arguments that he's making there about the Metro mayor, saying you've got a mayor now with a much wider area, with a different kind of cabinet that the mayor himself cannot select, that it's just the leaders of the councils surrounding Bristol, and that's actually a much better model. It's almost as if these two are now pulling against each other.
Well, obviously, there is a muddle over local government in
there
my
is.
View.
Oh, yeah.
We need to have a root
deliberate,
and branch
reform. Surely deliberate.
Well, one might wonder, because all of this has been set in train by the Tories, and of course what happens is that in order to get money for regions, you have to have a mayor very often. That's part of the deal. And the amounts of money which are available are relatively small. They sound a lot, you know, if you're not
Well, when they
part
first
of it.
Brought the mayor in, I seem to remember there was something called the City Deal.
That's right.
Which was another bribe. So
that's right.
Do this and we'll give you a load of money, and then you can sort out the mess afterwards.
That is what happens all the time. But in order to actually invest in large infrastructure projects, you have to do what national government wants you to do and makes money available for you to do. So it's a fundamentally anti-democratic process. But just to go back to the question, which is on the ballot paper, the question of ballot paper is not about the Metro mayor. So whatever George Ferguson says, that's not part of a discussion. The question on the ballot paper is, do you want a committee system or do you want a mayor? And it seems to me that he is simply kind of, you know, throwing, you know, sort of stardust in our eyes, you know, deflecting from the fundamental question. Now, the Liberal Democrats wanted that to be the question, and that's the question on the ballot paper. And as far as I'm concerned, I've already made my case. It seems to me it's too early to say. We've been living through 10 years of extreme effects of austerity, of a pandemic, to then say we're going to mess around changing our governance system when there are so many more important things we need to be doing in local government seems to me to be ludicrous.
Martin, what about Estella's argument there? She's really saying, look, this is not what we need right now. We've got much more important things to do. We don't need another reorganisation here in Bristol.
Well, I hear what she says. I was opposed to having a mayor in the first place. It was voted through by a tiny minority of the population, so they had a referendum, and of course the actual participation was minimal. And of course what we've actually got, as Estella just said, is a total mess in local government. And I don't see that this issue of whether we keep or don't keep a mayor, to my mind, is not really fundamental.
Did central government want local government to just go away? They seem to. They're just pulling all the funding.
Well, they're not just pulling all the funding. They've pulled the funding by 70%, as Estella has said, but they've also changed the criteria on which you can get the funding. So it's studies have shown that places like Knowsley in Liverpool, which are the most deprived in the country, have had the most cuts per head, and East to Dorset have been given a little uplift because they've changed the way the funding is dished out. And that is the real scandal at the heart of central government's management of local government affairs. Well, and of course, it's you know, this goes back to the imposition of the poll tax in the 1980s, which wasn't, of course, imposed in Northern Ireland because they knew it was absolute dynamite and would blow the place apart. So they've still got the rates, which actually leads to local government in Northern Ireland having more resources than us with the ridiculous community charge.
This is a radical
charge.
Policy that says that people with money should pay tax. Well, no. Rather than possibly people with no money.
Yes, well, the whole purpose of the poll tax, which became the community charge, the council tax, is that it's on individual voters, so that they have to think twice. And, of course, what Margaret Thatcher thought when she brought it in, she went to Streatham and realised that people with big houses in Streatham were paying massive bills so that people in Brixton could have youth clubs. Well, and her attitude was, if you want youth clubs in Brixton, you've got to pay for it.
Back in the 1980s, a lot of people just went off the electoral register.
Well, that's right. That was another effect. And, of course, the electoral registers are very, very corrupt, especially in inner-city areas. Lots of people avoid being on the electoral register for that reason. And then, of course, the boundaries of the constituencies are drawn upon the back of that. And what the Boundary Commission are now going to do, with the government pushing them, is probably, you know, gerrymander away maybe 20 Labour seats at the next election. This is what happened in Northern Ireland for years and years and years and years and years until it blew up in the 1960s.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of pushback by Marvin against this cutback in local government funding. He doesn't really seem to go for the jugular. That's our present mayor.
Well, that's not true, because one of the things that he is part of the Core Cities Group, which is all the major cities, which are virtually all Labour-run. Now, they make regular representations of national government. The problem you've got is the people you're criticising are the ones who are going to give you money. So, it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
Must be nice to them. Oh, God.
In Germany, it doesn't work like that. Local government has got its own resources
based
on their own taxation locally, and there is some redistribution between regions. Yeah. That you can't just have locally based taxation because some communities don't have the resources, and you've got to have some national redistribution
an increase in most areas of the country in council tax here. For a lot of people, they're wondering, well, what am I getting for my money? All I can see is services being shut down. But this came up at Prime Minister's before. We're going to hear a bit more from George Ferguson in a minute, but whilst we're on the topic of council tax,
thank you,
Mr. Speaker. My Conservative Council in Kensington and Chelsea charges £500 less council tax than neighbouring Camden Labour. And it has four times as many bin collections. You haven't misheard. £500 less, four times as many. Does my right honourable friend agree with me that everyone who wants low council tax and good services needs to vote Conservative?
Mr. Speaker, do I agree with my honourable friend? There is not a syllable with which any sensible person in this country could possibly dissent.
Well, I could dissent from that particularly. Anyway, Estella, what do you make of that comment? £500 less council tax and multiple times more bin collections from Kensington and Chelsea to Camden.
Well, Kensington and Chelsea has got a lot more rich people than Camden. And as I said to you earlier, most revenue spending now is on things like social care. It's not on bin collection.
Don't the more wealthy expect more from their council? They have the time to lobby their council, to tell the council, I want this, I want that.
I don't know that they do, actually. They certainly don't necessarily need more from their council. The poorest people are those who are dependent on things like social care, are dependent on things like public libraries, and those are the people we need to be looking after. And Camden has much larger numbers of poorer people than Kensington and Chelsea.
Yeah, so Martin, what's going on with Kensington, Chelsea and Camden there? Because it seems quite obvious. If you want to pay less council tax, vote Tory.
Well, it's worse than that. In actual fact, the money that's being distributed post-Brexit to different parts of the country, you know, to make up for the EU money, is going to Tory marginal seats. So they're rigging the electoral system nationally as we speak. And they're hoping to scrape through in the next election on the back of it. Don't forget, they've only got 43% of the vote at national level.
Well, the implication
no
of
other
that,
country in Europe would they
the
be the
implication
government at
of
all.
That of that question is that Labour are hopeless when it comes to running local authorities good value.
No, what actually that's happens is the poorest places in the country, like Liverpool and Tower Hamlets, have far more problems to deal with than Kensington and Chelsea and people in Clifton. And in actual fact, what they're having to do, because as we said, 70% cut in their budget, but they've got actually real needs they've got to fulfil.
Well, it's now, things, what like, in the things 19- like adoption, social services, all these things are much, much greater in a poor area.
Absolutely.
You know, there are all sorts of consequences from poverty. That's
right. And of course, what's actually happened over the 30, 40 years that we've had this ridiculous regime in power in this country is that they have savagely downgraded the poorest parts of the community because they don't count. It doesn't matter. I mean, they don't change anything in general elections.
Written off.
But they're written off because people in Liverpool have been voting Labour forever. They're still voting Labour. And, of course, they're never going to get any look in for any kind of money ever.
And they will end up blaming the council.
Oh, yes.
And for things that the council has hardly any control
right.
over.
So the council then ends up... The strategy is that all the nasty stuff of cuts is done by the local councils run by the Labour Party in the poorer areas. Meanwhile, places like East Dorset get a little up. Lift because they tweak the formula by which the formula is a deprivation formula. Yeah. But the way the Tories do it, but rural areas need extra money because it's so difficult to deliver services in rural areas.
Well, there's
and so
buses
on and so on.
And all that
exactly. And in other words, what's really going on is class war by other means. And what the problem for Labour Party politicians running the big cities is that they haven't actually got the means to change things. Back in the earlier part of the last century, it was possible that local government could pioneer new stuff. It's now virtually impossible, and therefore they end up managing the austerity programme for the government. Now, of course, in the 80s, you got Liverpool Council refusing to set a rate, supposedly going to prison. There was a huge row within the Labour Party. I don't think anybody wants to go down that road again because it didn't work. But on the other hand, it really is, it's a trap for the Labour Party because, people like Andy Burnham, who could be a national figure, get shoved into managing Manchester. He's doing a reasonable job as far as I can see. And he's obviously very popular
he's
there.
He's just kind of
but
running around with his fingers in the dike.
Yeah, but at the same time, they can't actually move anything forward from that position because we've got to change national policy.
He's constantly having to react to what central government.
Absolutely. And managing austerity, quite right, and having to make really, really difficult decisions, with competing, equally deserving groups, basically. Are you going to cut money from here? Are you going to cut money from there? And then being told by Boris Johnson his ludicrous, pompous way, but it's just about bin collection. That's only a small part of council services.
Not for the people who vote Tory. That's their perception.
That is true.
They don't see all of the child protection, for example.
No, exactly.
Child protection? What's that?
That
means that horrible family living on the other side of town that I don't like and I don't want to... Why are we helping them?
And also, of course, the extent to which the kind of legal requirements, the statutory requirements, are much, much more rigorous now than they were 30 or 40 years ago. Yeah. So when you talk about things like child protection, it costs a lot of money for good reason, because you have to do it properly. You can't just get a volunteer to go and do it, But then that's all beneath the surface of what people see often when they think about their
council
services.
And also, as you say, the council tax is a way to punish Labour voters in poorer areas. Because the rates went previously, it was a property tax, so easy to collect. Yep. They don't pay you and found the property.
It was actually incredibly devious, wasn't it, when it was first introduced.
But anyway. And the property tax in which you transferred wealth from one part of the society to another.
Absolutely, that's exactly what's happened. Yeah. And it's not a question of, I get fed up with people talking about what the council should and shouldn't do. The council effectively has very little power. That's the reality. And of course, when you're campaigning in a local council election, you don't really want to say that to people. We're going to change things. We're going to improve things. But I personally think it's more honest to say to people, we're actually not able to do anything very much here. We need to change national government
Estella,
policy.
It does start to look, doesn't it, with the energy price hikes and the food price hikes, that people are in a kind of trap, really.
Yes,
that,
absolutely.
Increasingly, not just people on zero-hours contracts, but more and more people on the bottom half of the ladder are finding it, basically, that they are working all hours God sends in order just simply to pay the rent, to pay the fuel tax, to pay the food bill, and there's nothing left.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's appalling what's happening. And we've basically got a Tory mismanagement of the economy for the last 5 or 6 years at least, you know. And one of the things I think we need to remember is that there were no food banks in this country, you know, just over a decade ago. No food banks. And what's shocking is the extent to which food banks have become normalised and that people who are in work, people like nurses and teaching assistants, are becoming reliant on food banks at the end of a month because they can't make ends meet. Now, that to me is an absolute disgrace.
It's not just the students that are being driven into debt, is it?
No, not at all. It's what's called the working poor. So these are people who are trying to do an honest job every day, working very hard, often doing exactly the kind of job that keeps our society going. And they're the ones who are being... who are experiencing this at its most
extreme.
Well, isn't
that funny? That's the public sector,
getting
a hammering from the Tories, funnily enough. Anyway, let's go back to George Ferguson, because he's got some quite serious criticisms. Well, we do, yeah. So quite serious, because he knows he's been an insider. He's been on the insiders there, as you have, and he's got a different point of view, but we ought to hear him. And it's the one city policy, one of the things that he doesn't like, which is this getting rid of the councillors and actually bringing in loads of people from outside to make a lot of these policy making decisions, as well as he's also got a bit of a beef about the way that planning is not supposed to be being controlled by the mayor, but effectively it is.
The one city is the mayor's one city. It's the one city for some. It's the one city for those that agree with the mayor. And I have many, I've heard of many instances of people who wanted to be part of one city who have asked difficult questions and therefore have been left out. And so I think the one city is pretty fraudulent in that respect. It's sad because I think the principle of one city is absolutely right. And when it was, you know, when it was first voiced, I thought, well, that's actually a very good name for what I wanted to do. But I don't think it's followed through as being truly one city. Well, I know it hasn't. On the planning front, the mayor is meant to have absolutely no authority or influence over development control. But there is clear evidence that the mayor's office has been interfering very strongly in development control, calling in the senior planning officers and instructing them as to what the mayor requires. And this has resulted in some of the high buildings that were proposed in my time being doubled in height when I was trying to reduce them in height. And so we now have a 26-storey building that's just completing on Castle Park. There's now a proposal for another 25 or 26 story building adjacent to it. These interfere terribly with the character of the historic city and the enjoyment of the use of the park. And so I think that we have got a very different planning regime now in Bristol, and we've got planning officers following the will of the instructions of the mayor, and that is very different. I wasn't able to do that. Of course, you can let it be known that you like something or other, but there should be absolutely no direct influence from the mayor's office over the planning system. And there are some huge planning permissions being granted, which I think a lot of people won't appreciate the damage until it actually happens. But as an architect, I have the privilege of understanding what these things will be like.
Okay, well, if George Ferguson thought one city was such a great idea, why didn't he implement it? Because he had to wait for Marvin to do it, so clearly he hadn't actually thought of it before.
Take us through the one city. What is it in a nutshell?
Oh, well, it's basically a grouping of people who, as I said before, it includes trade unionists, includes people from industry, local businesses, the public sector, who come together to discuss issues. Now, as far as I understand it, they don't make policy. Those ideas are fed into policy development.
They're kind of advisory groups, really.
It's an advisory group,
often,
yeah.
Their ideas are often taken up.
Yes.
But the principle here is the mayor doesn't really like what the councillors the ideas the councillors have. We've got, is it 80 councillors, 70 councillors?
70, yeah.
Lots and lots of them. And so he's decided, well, rather than have councillors, I just want to handpick a bunch of people who will tell me
nonsense.
What I want. Tell
that is
that's what George
nonsense.
Is implying.
I know, I know he's implying it. The problem is, poor old George never was a councillor. He had no idea, really, what councillors did, no sense of what you might do for your local community, your local ward. He came in, he became the mayor, and he thought it was all about the kind of froth at the top, basically. And he's now discovering that maybe that isn't what being the mayor is all about.
Well, maybe he wasn't an expert at that, but he was supposed to be anyway, an expert at architecture. I mean, obviously the other architects of the country thought he was good enough to, you know, be their boss, basically. And so what do you make of what he's saying there about planning and development? Because,
well,
I mean, that big building that's going up on Castle Park,
yeah.
I mean, it is completely changing the feel of the whole area, that part of the city, and, of course, blotting the sun out for a large part of
the
day.
Well, I do understand people's concerns. Of course I do. But the fact of the matter is that while George Ferguson was mayor, hardly any houses were built in Bristol, and he basically oversaw the intensification of a profound housing crisis in this city. Now, we have people
that wasn't just a Bristol thing, was it? It was a national
thing. Well, it isn't just a Bristol thing, but Bristol is a wealthy city. Bristol ought to be able to provide housing for its citizens. We have people living in vans in this city, and these are not travellers. These are people who've got jobs, and they cannot afford to live anywhere else. And it seemed to me that we do have brownfield sites. In my old ward of Lotleys, we have brownfield sites. George and did nothing to ensure that we built houses there. Now, it does take a long time to do that and to move the policy, but to have a policy of house building to ensure that those who work in Bristol and come from Bristol can live in Bristol seems to me to be a good principle.
Yeah, we have affordable housing now, don't we, going up. Actually, if you look at these buildings, these so-called affordable houses, which, of course, for many people are completely unaffordable, they're actually smaller rooms, smaller buildings than the old council houses used to be.
Yeah, I know. But that isn't just about the council. That's to do with the price of land, which the council doesn't control, unfortunately. But you're right. Houses are getting smaller.
They are. They're like, and they like putting mirrors in them to make the rooms look smaller. They have smaller chairs, smaller settees in. I mean, it's almost... what's happening with housing, Martin?
Well, underlying all of this is what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England. And it's people in this country are used to the idea that the housing market dominates everything. And so if you're a middle-class person...
Well, the reason for that is that people spend more money on housing than anything else, pretty much, don't they?
Yeah, but some people make an awful lot of money out of that as well. So there is a scam. I mean, as house prices rise, somebody like the Duke of Westminster, who owns the whole of central London and lots of other places beside, or Richard Drax, who is the biggest landowner in Dorset and also owns stuff in
the Duke of Buccleuch,
and the
West
Indies,
that's right, they came out. Their wealth increases exponentially.
But the Church of England?
At the lowest level, you've got the, you know, potential Tory voter who's just left university and paid off their, you know, daddy's paid off their student debt.
Loan,
and they get on the housing ladder, and that is just free money for life. And that is economically
irrational. It's only free money for life if the house prices keep going up.
Well,
it?
Yes, but it's only for many people, it's become the way they plan their lives is around this housing scam. And of course, that's not true in countries like Germany, where even wealthy people who own businesses rent very nice apartments, but they rent. And there's rent controls in places like Berlin, so that the landlords.
So should people just give up any idea of owning their own home?
Well,
that actually costs to buy roughly what it costs to build, because you know you're now paying a massive extra premium.
All right.
For the cost of the land, because the land is the main thing that people are supposed to invest in to get a return. They can't get a return in a bank account anymore because the interest rates are so low. So they're investing in land. It's money in the bank land nowadays.
That's right. So in other words, people are using housing as a financial services plan, not to live in. Yeah. Now, that has very deleterious economic effects over the long term. So, for example, it leads to a situation, what they used to call in economic circles, stop-go, although in actual fact it's go-stop. So every time the British economy starts to pick up and starts to go, the housing market in the southeast of England rises dramatically. Then, of course, inflation takes hold, as it is now, and then they have to put the brakes on to stop that, which means that all the industrial parts of Britain, north of the Wash, are constantly backing dashed back into the, and that's why we've deindustrialised, so that other people in the southeast of England can have conservatories, gardens, and all the rest of it. And so again, it's a redistribution
of
wealth.
The deindustrialisation is something which has been part of the planning, really, for the last 40 years or so,
well,
where as these industries are outsourced, it can be done cheaper. We're bringing stuff in cheaper from abroad with cheap labour than the labour costs here.
Yes, but at the same time, you can make it worse by pursuing your own domestic policy, which puts money in the pockets of the landlord class. Let's call them that. That's what they are. Many Tory MPs are buy-to-let landlords.
I just call them the golf players.
Yes, well, okay. Well, but the point is that people get the idea that they are basically deserving of this wealth, and it doesn't cross their minds that in actual fact that's a free gift from society at other people's expense. And that, you know, these are very much the same people who don't like people scrounging on benefits. And you feel like saying, I mean, just think about the sale of council houses when it happened, which basically that's the reason for the sell-off of the council houses, which was initiated by Thatcher and then nothing done about it under New Labour, created a whole new class of people who used to be renters from the council, but because they bought their houses at the price they got it, they were given up to £500,000 each by the government.
Well, you can't blame them.
No, I can't blame them, but that's my money, and I'm not. I don't own a house.
That was a structural thing that was hardwired into it.
No, no. But what you should have done if you're going to do that is you sell them at cost. You sell them at what they're really, really worth. In that case, it wouldn't have been attractive to people. The other thing, if I can just finish, is that the whole tax regime on buying a house, it means that you don't pay capital gains on it, and people are encouraged to buy houses. And the reason we do that is because in the 1920s, the Tory governments decided that what we need is working class people owning their own houses so they don't go on strike, and we'll also make them Tory voters. And that's, so in order to prop up the Tory party, the British economy has been successively undermined in my lifetime to the point where we've been completely destroyed as an industrial power.
I did ask you what's going on with housing, and I think you gave a pretty good summary there of what's happening. But there is another problem here, and that is that because housing and the cost of housing, the price of housing is so important in the general economy, there is an absolute paranoia about allowing house prices to go down. The idea of building new houses, which would make it cheaper, so, for example, building houses at cost on very cheap land, for example, is out the window, because that would affect the profits of the house building industry. And also, good God, the actual price of housing might start going down, yeah. Estella.
Well, yes, exactly. But local councils don't have any powers to control that, unfortunately.
Well, no.
I wish we had rent control powers. I really, you know, over a number of times people have asked us why we can't do that. And we don't have those powers at the moment, and we're not going to get them. But in my old ward of Lockleaze, for example, which, as you probably know, is a post-war council estate, you know, and it was built with, you know, semi-detached houses, big gardens, you know, it's actually quite a sort of utopian.
Not like these new ones with no gardens.
Well, I know, but 30% of that housing is now in the hands of private landlords. And of course, a lot of it is rented to students. Now, this is not the fault of the students. Who can blame the ones who live near their university? But what you're finding is that landlords are squeezing in 6, 7, 8, 9 students into a what would have been a family house. They're charging something like over £1,000 a month for rent on those properties, something which an ordinary family probably couldn't pay. And that's squeezing local people out of the market. And it's also, of course, leaving those houses empty for half a year as well, so they're not being used. And of course, that's another incentive, because it's short-term lets. So if you're a landlord, you probably don't want to be renting it to people for year after year.
It's creating a divided society.
Absolutely.
A massively divided society, with the vast majority being landless, having nowhere that's their own, that they can call their own. Anyway, I think we've done a pretty good job on talking about the way housing works or doesn't work here in Bristol and elsewhere. My final clip with George Ferguson, though, is about something which has been a controversy in the national press, and been, I think it was Sonia Poulton, the former Daily Mail freelancer, that put this out originally a few weeks ago, and Stella Perrett, the cartoonist, brought it up on this programme when she was here a few weeks ago. It's called The Family Sex Show, and it involves naked actors in front of children as young as 5 years old. There's been quite a lot of controversy, apparently, around the world. As George says here, quite a lot of the criticism has also come across the Atlantic. But the show has now been pulled in all its venues, so it's not going to be being shown anymore, apart from apparently to a private audience. Maybe it was even last night in Bath. So I did tackle George on this, you know, because he was the owner of the venue, which is, well, actually not quite the owner of the venue, but it's the tobacco factory in Bedminster, and that's the where the theatre is, where this performance was going to take place.
The family sex show, I think, is completely misunderstood by the critics. I mean, the name is provocative and people made assumptions, but most of the critics are coming from the other side of the Atlantic. We've had some pretty nasty letters and messages and stuff on social media. There's been nothing direct at the tobacco factory apart from the effect on some of the staff, which is why the theatre decided that they had to cancel it. I'm not part of the theatre, but I absolutely defend their right and am against that sort of censorious censorship that some people who just want to object to anything with the word sex in it, who don't understand the good nature, the good humour, the good education that is intended by the family sex show. So I think it's a misunderstanding, and sometimes a deliberate misunderstanding by those who should know better.
So is it okay to have naked adults in front of five-year-olds in a performance?
In the right circumstances, I think it is. And theatre is a place where you can do those things as long as there is consent by the parents, and the parents are fully warned as to the nature of the show. So I think it's too easy to be censorious without actually knowing what it's about and seeing what it's about.
They're saying that this is sexualizing prepubescent children.
Oh, well, that's a load of bollocks. Okay.
All right, George.
I can't give you a better answer than that.
Okay. Apologies for the swearing there. I'm not sure if that was the most appropriate word to use in the circumstances. But anyway, that's former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, also the owner of the tobacco factory in Bedminster, underneath which the theatre company operates. Estella, what do you think about this idea? I mean, just the title, Family Sex Show, sounds a little bit peculiar.
Sounds a bit dodgy, doesn't it? I mean, I know absolutely nothing about this show, and I can't possibly comment on whether it's on its artistic merits or anything else. I'm not sure I would want to take a five-year-old child to see this, I have to say. There is something about having live performance which is more uncomfortable, isn't there, than perhaps other media. So I don't really know enough about it to comment, I'm afraid.
Well, what they say is using real life bodies, personal stories, real life bodies, what's that, songs and movement, the family sex show puts the good stuff at the forefront of conversation and imagines a future where there is no shame but a celebration of difference, equality and liberation. One unnamed spokesperson for the show said, Martin.
Well, obviously no necrophilia then. Yes, well, we debated this the other week with Stella Perrott, who's sort of strong feminist, and she objected to it on the grounds that you're suggesting that it was sexualising young children. I don't know. In principle, I would say that if people don't want to go and see something, then don't go.
The thing is, of course, we're talking here about kids.
Yeah, but the kids would have to go with their parents. Well, five-year-olds are not going to be taken in on their own, are they? And they're not even being taken by their school. They'd have to go with their family. That's, I presume, is the idea of the show, that families turn up. And then they discuss, you know, and so parents, instead of having to talk to their children at home, they can, you know, they can get a show where they can discuss all these things in a show.
Well,
I don't know.
It's one thing talking to children, it's another thing taking your clothes off to
demonstrate. I mean, if you know that that's what's going on, parents would have to decide whether they wanted to take their children. I must admit, as a child, I would probably think, oh no, what a bore. But there you are. You might be dragged there by your parents in order to be educated about sex, and you know, if you're a child, then that's the sort of thing that happens, isn't it?
What they're saying is that you shouldn't be ashamed of nakedness, even with children.
Well, I think,
I'm not sure if shame is quite the right word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's surely, you know, nakedness is appropriate in certain situations, not in others.
Well, I don't know what the show actually had in it. You know, it's like, well, what's actually in this show? And I bet you loads of the people who complained about it have no idea what's in it either. I mean, let's face it, it hasn't even taken place because of all the objections.
So you think there should be some sort of trial run?
Well, I think the thing is, I think George Ferguson's point is well made, which is that why should you be able to tell other people what they do? You know, there's an issue about censorship here, isn't there?
Yeah, but there's also an issue of child protection.
Well, there is.
They're saying that actually this goes against a lot of the safeguarding laws.
No, I'm quite sure that they would have to fulfil all of those criteria in order to put the show on. Yeah, no.
Fingers crossed. Anyway, back to bigger things and the cost of living we were talking about just now, particularly around housing. We've also got the local elections coming up, and that was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions this week with the Labour leader Keir Starmer and the Conservative leader Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
So they're the party of excess oil and gas profits, yeah, and we're the party of working people. Yeah. The Tory government's had its head in the sand throughout the cost of living crisis. First, they let prices get out of control. Then they denied it was happening. They failed to do anything about it, and then they made it worse with higher taxes. Because of his choices, we are set to have the slowest growth and the highest inflation in the G7. Mr. Speaker, a vote for Labour next week is a vote for a very different set of choices. To pay their fair share and reduce energy costs. We wouldn't hammer working people with the worst possible tax at the worst possible time. We'd insulate homes to get bills down, and we'd close the tax avoidance schemes that have helped his Chancellor, where is he, reduce his family's tax bill while putting everyone else's up. That's a proper plan for the economy. So why doesn't he get on with it and finally make choices that make things better, not worse, for working people?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I can tell the Right Honourable Gentleman, I listened to him over many weeks and many years, this guy is doomed to be a permanent spectator, Mr. Speaker. We have a plan to fix the NHS and fix social care. They have no plan. We have a plan to fix our borders with our deal with Rwanda. They have no plan. We have a plan to take our economy forward. They have no plan. Let me tell you something. He talks about the elections. He talks about the elections in a few days' time, Mr. Speaker. Let me remind him that everywhere you look at Labour administration, it is a bankrupt shambles. Hammersmith Council spent £27,000 on EU flags, Mr. Speaker, 2 years after the referendum. Labour-run Nottingham Council bankrupt because of their investment in some communist energy plan of the kind that he now favours. He should apologise for it. Labour-run Croydon bankrupt, Mr. Speaker, because of their dodgy property deals. And never forget, Labour-run Britain in 2010, bankrupt because of what the Labour government did. And they said they had no money left. Mr. Speaker, he looks at council tax. Look at the difference between, he boasts he lives in Islington or Camden or somewhere like that. He should contrast neighbouring Westminster, which has the lowest council tax in the country, and better services too. That's the difference between Labour and Conservative across the country, Mr. Speaker. Vote Conservative on the 5th of May.
That was a bit of a almost a party political broadcast, Sarah Stella, for the Conservative Party, but with Boris taking about twice the amount of time to make his pitch than Keir Starmer for the Labour Party was.
Well, as usual, bloated rhetoric, wasn't it? He didn't actually say anything very much at all. He's got a plan for everything, but doesn't actually tell us what the plan is. At the moment, their plan is crashing the economy, it's driving people into penury, and we're letting those kind of global companies get away with murder who are not paying proper taxes, and you know, failing to stop millions of pounds being paid in bonuses for the heads of energy companies. I mean, it's just astonishing. So they're not prepared to actually take action to ensure that the ordinary people of Britain and indeed Bristol get a fair deal. I mean, it's just, you know, ludicrous.
Well, once upon a time there was something called nationalisation. This isn't really even, Keir Starmer is not talking about nationalising these oil energy companies.
No.
Would you like to see him doing more of that?
That, That's a really good question, and I don't have an answer for it really. And I'll tell you why. The energy business is incredibly complex and volatile. It's not a simple matter of nationalising what's available right here in the UK. You're actually talking about a kind of complex structures of ownership, which might mean you end up having to compensate mega corporations, which are not even based in the UK, if you buy back those things
from
them.
Well, Shell have got a little bit less invested in Russia now.
They have. They have. But I think what I would say is that I would favour much better regulation, especially on things like the payment of tax, and especially on the way in which, you know, prices are charged.
See, I mean, the difference between the privatised version, so I mean, I think it was in the 1980s, we had a golden share in BP, for example, that went. And it means that these energy firms who, let's face it, they don't make this energy, they just stick a pipe in the ground and it comes bubbling up in different forms. They are being used now for wealthy people to buy shares in them and to make more money out of them, rather than in the old days that any profits that they made, first of all, they were encouraged to pretty much distribute this energy out there at cost. Now it's completely the other way around. Martin, what do you make of this inability of the Labour Party to start thinking about taking any of this back into public ownership again? This is effectively infrastructure we all need.
Well, I mean, there's an obvious immediate point, which is the Tories, if they had a different kind of leadership, would pick up on this idea of taxing the oil companies. It's a potential vote winner for them, and I see Rishi Sunak has suggested that he might consider it, although of course he's now trying to manoeuvre himself into position to become the Prime Minister. It's quite clear that countries which have a nationalised energy infrastructure, like Norway, for example, across the North Sea, have done much better than we have. And it's 40 years of stupidity that have led us into the mess we're in. Now, you can't get that changed back to what it was overnight. But, of course, during the Corbyn era, these things were discussed. And the way you do it is you regulate them very severely to the point where they can't make any money. And at that point, they give it to you. You don't have to spend any money when you nationalise it. That's how you nationalise things. You do it by regulating until eventually the private sector says, we don't want to do this. Of course, once you've got a nationalised industry, you can supply at cost, for example. You can cross-subsidise things. You can plan the economy. And that's, of course, what the Tories hate, the whole idea of that. And ultimately, of course, the reason they're not taxing the oil industry is because the oil industry funds them. That's where they get their money from. And almost, that's who they're representing.
You can almost hear, can't you, the ticking of the brains of the Tories and their shareholdings in the energy firms thinking, well, this is, you know, let's just make legislation so that I can get more money from my energy. You know, you've got a situation where if you're wealthy enough, you can just buy. I mean, we're talking here about gas, electricity, water, all these privatised industries. You can buy enough shares in that firm, not only to pay your bill in the dividends every year, but also to you know, to have a little bit of a return on the side as well. So you're investing in the infrastructure, but you're ending up paying absolutely nothing. Mm. And you're being subsidised by the poor. The rich are being subsidised by the poor. Mm.
That's right. And, of course, other countries, Norway being the obvious one, but of course we're talking about Russia later. Gazprom is owned by the Russian government.
This is,
and of course,
this
they can then use it and deploy it in various ways to achieve various objectives. I mean, which we can't do.
The lefties would probably call it exploitation. I'd call it evil. This is wrong, totally wrong. Where people who've got the money are using it to exploit people who are basically on the back foot, or, you know, down, well, and out. Some of them are facing homelessness. This is
the way that the capitalism has always functioned, but of course it's been intensified over the last 30 or 40 years to the point that young people growing up now can't remember a time when it was different. Mm. But it was different.
Yeah.
In actual fact, in the 1950s, in the 1950s, before, well, I was born at the very end of the 1950s, it was normal for the idea of the mixed economy. Yeah. You know, certain things are run by the government.
It was 1980 and Thatcher really did change all of that, didn't it? Anyway, our final clip before we say goodbye to Estella is going to be about care homes. There's a big legal decision this week about people who died after being put into care homes.
Daisy Cooper.
Mr. Speaker, today a court has found that the government acted unlawfully when its policies led to the discharge of untested patients from hospitals to care homes at the start of the pandemic. The court also found no evidence that the former Health Secretary addressed the issue of the risk to care home residents of such transmission, despite the government insisting at the time that a protective ring had been thrown around care homes. The government has once again been found to have broken the law.
Yep.
Will the Prime Minister apologise to the families of the thousands and thousands of people who died in care homes in the first half of 2020? And will he also apologise to care workers for the shameful comment that he made in July 2020 when he said that too many care homes didn't follow procedures in the way that they could have?
Mr. Speaker, of course I want to renew my my apologies and sympathies for all those who lost loved ones during the pandemic, people who lost loved ones in care homes, and I want to remind the House of what an incredibly difficult time that was and how difficult that decision was. And we didn't know very much about the disease, and the point I was trying to make, to which she refers, is the thing that we didn't know in particular, Mr. Speaker, was that COVID could be transmitted asymptomatically in the way that it was. And that was something that I wish we had known more about at the time. As for the ruling that she mentions, we will study it and we will, of course, respond further in due course.
Now, one of the problems with something like the pandemic in 2020 is that if the government gets it wrong, people die. And that's what we've seen this week. So what do you make of that decision and generally the way the government handled the pandemic?
The sort of careless insouciance with which he bats it away is really kind of characteristic of the way in which the government behaved, I think, throughout the pandemic to some extent. And especially Matt Hancock claiming there was this protective ring around care homes, when, to be honest, it was kind of patently obvious, wasn't it? I saw plenty of reports on the local news that clearly wasn't happening, that care homes were uncertain about what they were supposed to do, people were being, you know, decanted into them from hospital, obviously carrying the illness asymptomatically, and that's not the fault of those people or indeed of the care homes, who are often doing their best to deal with an unprecedented situation. It was a responsibility of the government to have a clear policy, and they didn't have one, and they didn't actually extend that support. And I would say also that most care workers are women. They are on minimum wage usually, but often the work they do requires enormous, you know, wells of strength and emotional support. I have nothing but admiration for people who work as care workers. It's a very, very hard job. And they too are put in danger by this. So we've actually got a situation in which people's loved ones are put in danger, many of whom died. And care workers, the very people whose jobs every day require them to go back into those care homes and look after older people and do the job often that they love to do. But they too were placed in an impossible situation. So it's ridiculous to simply wash his hands of it and say, well, we didn't know at the time.
Well, the idea is it's a national emergency. We must do what we're told by the government. There's a lot of our liberties disappeared for a while. Quite a long time, actually. Are there any other problems that you have with the way the government responded to the pandemic?
Well, you mean like having parties when nobody else is allowed to go anywhere? I mean, it seems to me that astonishing that the government thought that they were not required to obey the law, whereas everybody else was. And also they acted too little too late, didn't they? So they didn't actually impose lockdown until quite late in the day, by which time the pandemic was already spreading. And they had been warned that the best thing to do was to go hard and go quickly on lockdown. And they didn't do that. They dithered about it. And that undoubtedly did cost people's lives.
Also, before you go, Ukraine, we can't really let you go without giving you the opportunity to say something about that, if you'd like, because we'll be hearing in the second part from various correspondents, some of whom I've personally interviewed and some of which I've just grabbed off of the internet, about the potential for this turning into a Third World War. Yeah. I mean, even Liz Truss is now saying, well, we're going to make sure that the whole of Ukraine is liberated now from Russia. Now, this means that effectively that the breakaway regions that declared independence 8 years ago, she wants NATO to help Ukraine to re-liberate them. Now, the Russians are simply not going to stand for that. So that does sound as if they want a bigger, further confrontation. Yeah. Anyway, what do you make of it all? Because a lot of people, I think, you know, people who might not normally be interested in the news and politics are pretty frightened, actually.
Yeah, I it's interesting, isn't it, that it's become a story which everyone is aware of. And I think that actually British people have responded incredibly well, offering their homes, for example, organising, supplies to go to Ukraine. I certainly know of that happening in Lotlisa, I'm still in touch with, and I've been really touched by that. But this is an extremely serious situation. There's no doubt about it. And it seems to me that, broadly speaking, what's happening is that the government's responding appropriately insofar as they are supporting Ukraine but not actually engaging in conflict. But, you know, it's, for me, make no mistake about it, Putin is a megalomaniac. I mean, I'm not persuaded that this is the fault of the West. I think that Putin's been determined to do this and has been so ever since Crimea, basically. So, you know, he's not going to back down. And it's a very, very dangerous moment, it seems to me.
Martin, do you think this is something which is Putin's move, or is it a wider thing within the Russian population, the Russian elected representatives?
Well, obviously, we're going to cover this in a lot of detail in the next hour, so I won't go into too much detail. But it's pretty clear that if Putin was to die tomorrow of a heart attack, Russian policy would not change. His opinion poll rating...
I think there's some NATO people who rather want him to.
His opinion poll rating has gone up from 63% at the beginning of the crisis to 83% the last time I looked. And all the political forces in Russia, United Russia, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, the Liberal Democrat Party and Fair Russia, unanimously voted to recognise the two breakaway republics and to give the president the authority to take the necessary steps.
There are some rumours about the Ukrainian army planning to invade the Donbass.
Well, that's why
Ukrainian
army is now surrounded in the positions that they've been adopting for the last 18 months, which have been basically threatening to attack the breakaway republics. And the Russians have been saying, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And, of course, the negotiations at the Minsk agreements in 2015, the government in Kiev agreed to negotiate with the breakaway republics about autonomy within Ukraine. And that was brokered by the French and the Germans.
At the end of the day, this is Ukraine's territory. It's not Russia's territory, is it?
Well, it's the same way that Kosovo is not part of Serbia's territory now, because NATO went to war to make sure that Kosovo could be liberated from Serbia. That was the precedent. And, of course, this is the situation. Crimea, in particular, has only been part of the Ukraine since 1954.
Well, we'll be talking about this in a minute, but Crimea, what do you make of this, Estella? Crimea, we're now hearing from Liz Truss, you know, this is going to be liberated by NATO, and Britain wants to see the Russians kicked out of Crimea. Now, if you go down to that part of the world, you'll find a lot of ethnic Russians do not appreciate being told that they're not allowed to speak Russian in Crimea.
No.
And also that this is traditionally was always part of Russia. They don't want to be ruled by Kiev. So you've almost got an intractable problem here. We might be bogged down in this for many months, possibly even years.
Well, let's hope not. People have been talking about a frozen war, haven't they, in which this has sort of been continuing for a long time. I'm not an expert on foreign policy. It seems to me that claims, sort of neo-colonial claims about, well, they used to be part of us, so they're entitled to be part of us again, is akin to us claiming that the British ought to invade Ireland.
It's a bit like Israel, isn't it?
This is a question of self-determination.
That didn't go well either.
Well, it is a question of self-determination, but of course it's more self-determination leads to conflicting claims. If everybody lived in homogenous groups, and you can say you live over here, we live over there, the reality on the ground is there's always somebody on the wrong side of any line.
Wales and Scotland seem to be in the process of slowly ceding from Westminster, don't they?
Well, that's our version of this kind of thing. And of course, in our own country, this led to violence in living memory. So it's not surprising that Ukraine has only existed as a state after the breakup of the USSR in 1991. It had never been a state before that, and it's actually a hodgepodge of different regions. If you look at the political geography, the eastern-speaking regions were the big supporters of Yanukovych, who was kicked out by the coup in 2014, which was a totally unconstitutional and rather violent event.
I only realised recently that Poland was part of Russia up until the First World War.
Yes, that's right.
Part of the Russian Empire?
Yes.
That's not the same thing.
No. Well, no, the Poles would probably point that out, wouldn't they?
Yes, I think they would, quite rightly. They spoke a different language and a different culture.
Yes, but the Russian Empire was a multinational empire, as was the British Empire.
Well, yes,
at
it
the
was,
time.
Yeah. And I don't think we want to depend on imperialism, do we?
Well, I know, no, but it depends what you mean by imperialism. Because imperialism is actually an economic system. It's not just taking over other people's countries. And, of course, in Yugoslavia, the right to self-determination of breakaway republics was supported by arms. We went to war with Serbia.
That's true.
I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and for my sins, I supported NATO's intervention at the time. But for the same kind of reasons, I understand why the Russians are intervening. Don't forget, there's been no negotiations since 2015. The Russians said to the Ukrainians, will you negotiate? They said no, because they're pushing their army. Their army is now surrounded, but they were going to invade. That's clear. But they now can't invade, but the negotiations are taking place for the first time since 2015. And the first negotiation between the Ukrainians and the Russians, they came to Belarusia. They went back to Kiev to talk to Zelensky, and one of the negotiators on the Ukrainian side, Kiriev, was shot dead immediately by the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret police, as a traitor. Just like that.
Well, maybe he was a traitor.
Well, from their point of view, they thought he was. Now, you've got to understand that on the ground in the Ukraine, there is the same sort of antagonism between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers as there was between Serbs and Croats in Yugoslavia. And both sides in Yugoslavia were pretty determined that they were going to get the land.
Anyway, I'm going to give you the last word on this. Is there any chance of peace there, do you think, now, in the next few months?
I hope so.
Okay, so the tick nail, thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back talking more Ukraine in part two.
Jesus put this song into our hearts. Jesus put this song into our hearts. It's a song of joy no one can take away. Jesus put this song.
Our reading today is taken from Hebrews 13, verses 1 to 8.
Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. Marriage should be honoured by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." So we say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?" Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever.
My pal, he's the best in all the town, but don't you think him dead because he ain't. But since he's wed, he has had to knuckle down, and it's enough to wet the temper of a saint. He's a brewer's driver with a leg of mutton fist, and as strong as a bully or an horse. Yet in her hands he's like a little kid, oh I wish that I could get him a divorce. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. And Eddie is a fella what is 6 foot three, and her only 4 foot two. Eddie's been married not a month nor more, when underneath her farm goes Jim. Now isn't it a pity as the likes of her should cut up and the likes of him. Now Jim was taught he could sing a decent song, and at scrapping he had won some great renown. Well, it took two coppers for to make him move along, and another six to hold the fella down. But today when I axes would he come and have some beer, to the doorstep on tiptoe he arrived. I guess he says he don't shark or silly, I've got to clean the windows and the knives. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, oh, I'd let her know who's who. The nagging at a fella what is 6 foot three, and her only 4 foot two. Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her farm goes Jim. How oh, isn't it a pity as the likes of her should part up and the likes of him. On a Sunday morn, with a dozen pals or more, he'd play at pitch and toss along the lee. But now she bullies him a scrubbing of the floor, such a change, well, I never did see. With an apron on him, I twig him on his knees, rubbing up the old off stone. What with emptying the ashes and the shelling of the bees, I'm damned if he can call himself his own. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. The nagging at a fella what is 6 foot three, and her only 4 foot two. We hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her farm goes Jim. How oh, isn't it a pity as the likes of her should part upon the likes of him.
So we started there with Jesus Put This Song, and that is by goodness knows what. That's actually one of the songs from the Daily Service earlier this week. Then we had, curiously, from 1931, Gus Ellen, and It's a Great Big Shame, old musical comedy star. Extremely politically incorrect, if you want to listen to the lyrics of that one. And finally, from 1992, Open Your Mind, Usura. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner. So this week we'll be looking, we'll be talking to Alex Craner, to Scott Ritter, also looking at the Freemasonry and its and P2 particularly. Something prompted me to look again at that this week. But Martin, we're going to start by looking at the BBC's coverage of some of the visit of Gutierrez from the UN to Moscow and then to Ukraine. I mean, there was quite clearly a media line being put out by the Ukrainians that they were annoyed that the UN had gone to visit Moscow first. What was all that about?
Well, I mean, the Ukrainians are being advised by lots and lots of PR professionals and also, you know, military psychological operations people, and they're being told to bluster. They're being given, you know, quite specific directives about how to deal with the media and, you know, what sort of things to say, and, you know, they're whipping up basically a war fever in the West. That's what they're doing.
So let's have a listen first of all this week to this woman who's on BBC News every day, pretty much, Jenny Hill, reporting on the Ukrainian conflict and what she had to say on Tuesday about Gutierrez's visit to Moscow.
You know, when you look at state television, when you listen to the Kremlin and all of its officials, you do not get the sense that Moscow seriously wants peace. The tone here is aggressive, it's belligerent. It accuses the West of, by supplying weapons to Ukraine, intensifying the conflict and seeking to prolong it for as long as possible. The supply of weapons to Ukraine is, in effect, sort of sucked into the Kremlin's narrative, which says the West is the real enemy here. Russia is now under threat from Western aggression. And, you know, when I look at Vladimir Putin, watch him speaking, there is very little evidence from what he says and from the rest of his propaganda machine here that suggests that there is any kind of serious effort for peace. You know, just an hour or so back, Moscow, according to state news agencies, announced it would hold joint military drills with Belarus. Both air forces will be involved. Russia has said there will be no ceasefire until any kind of negotiated settlement is signed. No ceasefire to allow negotiations to go ahead. As I say, the language continues to be very belligerent. And, you know, look at what Mr. Lavrov has said, the way he has received Mr. Guterres. You know, he made very clear that Mr. Guterres is there because Moscow has indulged the UN's request for a meeting. He also said, you know, yes, we're going to discuss Ukraine. It throws up, it's catalyzed a number of problems for the Euro-Atlantic area. He's making clear that as far as he's concerned, the conflict and all of its consequences are more of an issue for the West than they are for Russia.
Well, I mean, when she says there that the Russians don't want peace, you've got to remember that since the Minsk Accords were signed in 2014 and 2015, the government of Kiev has been under an obligation from the UN Security Council to negotiate with the breakaway republics. They simply haven't done it for 8 years. They refused. They point blank refused to negotiate with them, even though they'd signed up to do that. And before all of this latest phase of the fighting, because of course the war's been going on for 8 years, the latest phase of the fighting where the Russians have upped the ante with the special military operation or whatever they want to call it, the Ukrainians refused to negotiate. But now they are negotiating. And I'd like to know what the position of the British government is, because the British government for 8 years were telling them not to negotiate, and we've just heard from Liz Truss today, or yesterday, that the Britain is in favour of the complete liberation of the Ukraine, including Crimea and the breakaway republics, all to be pushed back into line by force.
Well, the reason
now,
I,
that is not really a peaceful policy.
The reason I thought it was an interesting clip there from Jenny Hill, which is her name, the BBC lady, is the fact that she's telling us what's going on Russian TV. We are not actually allowed to see that for ourselves anymore.
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? So they go on, RT is saying this and that and the other, but you can't see it. We'll tell you what they're saying.
Well, what they're saying apparently on RT is actually it's the West that wants to prolong this, although actually really it's the Russians that do.
Well, I mean, basically, Biden said the other day that, and they're saying themselves, we've got to be in for the long haul here. Russia must be weakened. Russia must be seen to lose. All of this sort of stuff. I mean, who is it who really wants to fight to the last Ukrainian?
But, I mean, she's watching RT, maybe. You know, we're not allowed to. But she says that her interpretation of what she sees on RT is that the Russians don't want peace. As you said just now.
Yes, I know, but the West has the French and the Germans at one stage were saying to the government in Kiev, you've got to negotiate with the West, with the breakaway republics. But the British and the Americans have always said, no, we're not going to accept any kind of revision of the borders of Ukraine. Now, if you want to settle this, you've got to accept that there's going to have to be some revision of the borders. And the blank refusal to accept this by the Western powers is the problem. Zelensky at one stage was saying, and Kolomoisky, his oligarch backer, was saying, well, perhaps and Zelensky won the election on the basis of saying, we will negotiate with the rebels. He went down to talk to the hardliners in the military who are surrounding the Donbass republics, and they said, if you try and negotiate with the Russians, we will kill you. He then went back to the Western powers and said, I want to negotiate with the Russians, but my own military is saying they'll kill me. Will you back me if I say I'm going to negotiate? And they said, no, we don't want you to negotiate. So the Western powers, particularly Britain, have been keen for negotiations to take place.
At the same time, accusing the Russians of not wanting peace. We'll be hearing more about this from Alex Craner in a little while. But there is another aspect to all of this, Martin, and that is that it was back in last August, September, that we had two things. One was the withdrawal of all NATO troops from Afghanistan in a rather surprise move. And the other was the announcement that fuel prices were all going up. It does start to look as if the whole thing has been orchestrated from the West, and that they knew what was happening, about to happen in February, 6 months beforehand. You know, the idea that we might need our troops over in Europe. I remember actually at the time one of the only commentators saying, well, I wonder what these troops are going back for. What's their next move going to be? And so it does look as if this was something that was being planned. Now, some people might say, well, were the Russians in on that? But as you've explained, actually, you told me this. I didn't find it out myself, that the Russians had what they believed were plans or from the Ukrainian army to actually attack the Donbass region in February this year. So it almost looks as if this was orchestrated, this whole war, from the West, and they knew. And the evidence for that is that 6 months before it started, we were getting all the initial warning signs, troops being withdrawn from Afghanistan and announcements of massive fuel hikes.
Well, the obvious thing from the Russian point of view is the build-up of the Ukrainian forces on the border of Donbass and Luhansk. I mean, if it's a frozen conflict, you've got no reason to build your forces up there. If we've got a ceasefire, of course, there never was a proper ceasefire. They claimed that there was a ceasefire, but in actual fact, they carried on carrying out indiscriminate shelling of the breakaway republics, and they also carried out terrorist attacks within those republics. So Zakhachenko, who was the elected prime minister of Donetsk, was killed by a car bomb, presumably by the Ukrainians, and no doubt, in my mind, probably aided by British special forces. Now, this is what people, you know, people think that the Russians are reacting now, and they're just, you know, there's nothing happened before all this. This is the problem with a lot of what happens in the West, like when we go to war with Iraq or Libya or whatever. It's all something that happened 2 minutes ago, and people are not looking at the history behind it.
Yeah, but what's changed since the coup in 2014 then that's made the Russians do this now?
Well, what happened in 2014 was that it was a coup, and of course, as I've explained on this show before, the shootings in the Maidan Square, because of a court case that was carried out in Kiev, was carried out by a NATO death squad from Georgia. So that was actually violence, and then there was the massacre in the
that's not the point I'm trying to make, is actually, why didn't the Russians actually, you know, come into the Donbass, bring their troops in 2014? Why have they left it so long?
Well, there are people in Russia on the right of politics, like the Liberal Democrat Party, and on the left of politics, like the Communist Party, are saying exactly that. Why didn't we do something about it then?
And actually, there's been pressure on Putin to do that ever since.
That's right. And Putin, in fact, has resisted that pressure and said, no, we're going to try and do a deal.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it? Putin is being blamed for something that he's actually been trying to stop for the last 8 years.
That's right. In actual fact, people in Russia are well aware that Putin, in fact, has taken a very measured approach to this. He's been pushed into a corner where the political forces within Russia itself are not prepared, because they see on their TVs night after night people who've been killed by indiscriminate bombing and shooting by the Ukrainians into the Donbass
Shelling,
republics.
Yeah.
And of course, 14,000 people were killed in the initial fighting, and the vast majority of those people were Russian-speaking civilians from the breakaway areas. And therefore, when Schulz, the German Chancellor, went to Ukraine, he said that the idea that there was some kind of genocide going on in the East Ukraine was laughable. Well, I wonder if he's laughing now. In Russia, people inevitably are going to be on the side of their fellow citizens, because many of them have got Russian citizenship, who are being indiscriminately shelled by the Ukrainians.
Our US masters are up to all sorts of tricks. Blinken, and you'll miss him. He was over in Ramstein, which is where the United States keeps the nuclear weapons in Germany, at their base. And also, I remember, I think it was Jeremy Scarhill at The Intercept that did a brilliant article about how this was at the heart of the drone wars, that the Ramstein base was used as a coordination for all these drone killings that have been going on all over the world, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, etc. And so they were sitting in their nuclear drone killing base with the Germans and other NATO people. And Jenny Hill talked about that as well on the BBC this week.
And Jenny, given what you've just been saying there, what do you think is likely to be the Russian reaction to this meeting in Ramstein in Germany? 40 countries talking about how to step up and coordinate arms supplies to Ukraine, and that's all being coordinated by the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
It will provoke anger here. I mean, state TV presenters have been furious about American announcements about stepping up the amount of aid and military equipment they're going to send to Ukraine. But, like I say, it will also be wrapped up and presented to the Russian people as a further example of Western aggression.
Well, I think that's fairly obvious that the Russians are not going to be happy about Western politicians saying we're going to supply lethal weapons to people who are killing your troops. I mean, that would be, if help for heroes and all that, okay, people in this country will understand.
Yeah, it's all very well talking about this, as we're about to hear from Liz Truss talking about this in the Mansion House speech this week. But how practical is it for them to get weapons to the Ukrainian army? Are they going to parachute in these howitzers, these anti-aircraft, whatever they're called, the mobile anti-aircraft launchers? Are they going to parachute them into them?
Well, this is another thing. I mean, obviously, by saying you're going to supply weaponry to people who are, it's as if the Russians were saying, well, we're going to supply the IRA with everything they need, because they're obviously fighting a loyal, and would that be acceptable to the British government, back in the day? No, it wouldn't. Now, the point about this is that, in actual fact, also from a practical point of view, as Scott Ritter will no doubt point out further down the line, it's pointless. The main bulk of the Ukrainian army is now surrounded in the Donbass, in the positions where they were in order to try and invade the breakaway republics. Nobody can get anything to them. So all they're doing by supplying more weaponry is either it's going to end up being used as, criminals are going to get hold of it and shoot people and rob banks or whatever, or a lot of it's going to be sold on to developing countries by Ukrainian oligarchs, and a lot of it is simply just going to be destroyed by the Russians, because as it comes over the border, it will be hit by missiles.
Well,
and of course the Russians are saying, yeah, if you're, and because Liz Truss the other day was saying that we're going to supply weaponry to the Ukrainians so that they can attack on Russian soil. Now at that point the Ukrainians may say, right, that's a decision made in London, and the weaponry is coming from wherever it's coming from, we're going to put a missile on that because that's what we will do. This is how dangerous this kind of talk is. Instead of talking it down, what the West should be doing in this situation is trying to knock heads together, get some kind of political solution, because you can't, everybody ain't going to get what they want here. Yeah? It's clear there's going to have to be some kind of division of the spoil. It's been clear since 2014.
Yeah, isn't this irresponsible, pouring all these weapons?
Absolutely. It's absolutely irresponsible. And to claim that this is somehow helping the Ukrainians is completely perverse, because what will happen by encouraging the more extreme elements in the Ukraine, and that Britain has done that in spades. Our special forces have been training the Azov battalion. It's suspected that many British personnel are actually trapped in the Avstol plant with them.
In Mariupol. That's right.
If Russian special forces were found to be embedded with Saddam Hussein's forces trying to kill British soldiers when they invaded Iraq, would we have been happy with that? No, we wouldn't. We would have deserved it if that had been the case.
Or Russians supplying bombs to Basque terrorists, for example.
Yes.
Separatists.
The point is that if you're going to say it's okay, we're not going to get involved in a fight with the Russians, but we're going to encourage other people to fight, you, and we're going to give them weaponry, the Russians may say,
there's two other ingredients here. One is private military companies, the other is mercenaries.
Yes, and of course that allows the West to have a cutout and say, well, it's not actually our armed forces, it's these private military companies. But we all know that the money to pay for those private military companies is being given, they're being provided to the Ukraine on tick, but ultimately that's British taxpayers who are paying for those military companies to be there. Now, to all intents and purposes, the West is supporting the neo-Nazi elements. I mean, you see, we're not even supporting the regular Ukrainian army, we're supporting the more extreme elements who want to fight. There's a minority that want to fight whatever, and we have been encouraging that minority to fight. That is not just irresponsible, it's wicked.
So let's go to Liz Truss. I mean, it was interesting that she was doing her annual speech to the Mansion House this week, when she announced that we wanted to help the Ukrainians to liberate the whole of Ukraine, including Crimea. Because the Mansion House is the City of London, effectively, isn't it? It's an interesting place for her to be making that speech.
Yeah, well, as I understand it, the Mansion House speech is usually made by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so I'm a bit surprised.
I'm a bit surprised that she's doing it. Different of the major departments all do Mansion House speeches various sorts, as I understand it.
Okay.
But this is, it's a kind of an esoteric thing, isn't it, the city and the guilds that still run it.
Yes, well, I mean, it's part of the feudal constitution of our liberal country. Yeah. And
they talk about the City of London as almost a state within a state.
Well, it is a state within a state.
Apparently the Queen has got to ask permission if she wants to come into the City of London.
Well, I mean, I think it's very indicative of the British have played a particularly pernicious role in this whole crisis. I suspect that no doubt MI6 were very well aware of the Maidan massacre and the fact that it was orchestrated not by the Kiev regime. It was a NATO operation, because they brought people in from outside the country to do the massacre. And of course that should have been all over the media in the West. The BBC should have reported when the court in Ukraine in 2018 found the Burkut riot police innocent, and also pointed the finger at NATO for orchestrating the massacre. That should have been the moment for wake-up calls across Europe.
So as Liz
Truss... But many, many people simply do not know the facts about this stuff.
As Liz Truss, our Foreign Secretary, gives her speech to the Illuminati of the London... quite a few Freemasons, certainly, amongst this lot, the listening, I'm sure. They're keeping their fingers crossed that she can distinguish the difference between the Black Sea and the Baltic.
The war in Ukraine is our war. It's everyone's war, because Ukraine's victory is a strategic imperative for all of us. Heavy weapons, tanks, aeroplanes, digging deep in our inventories, ramping up production. We need to do all of this. Our sanctions have already seen Russia facing its first external debt default for a century, and we need to go further. There must be nowhere for Putin to fund this appalling war, and that means cutting off oil and gas imports once and for all. At the same time, we need to deliver support for the Ukrainian people. It means helping refugees, it means delivering food, medicine, other essentials, and it means keeping the economy afloat. It also means holding the Putin regime to account for the appalling crimes that have been committed. And when the guns finally fall silent in Ukraine, it means making sure Kiev has the resources it needs to maintain security, deter further attacks, and rebuild. That's why we're working on a joint commission with Poland to ensure Ukraine is equipped with NATO standard weapons. And it's why we're determined to work with the US, with the EU, and other allies on a new Marshall Plan for the country. Ukraine deserves nothing less than a landmark international effort to rebuild their towns and cities, regenerate their industries, and secure their freedom for the long term. We're doubling down. We will keep going further and faster to push Russia out of the whole of Ukraine. And this has to be a catalyst for wider change. We need to apply this tough stance to the threats that are emerging beyond Ukraine. Our approach is based on three areas: military strength, economic security, and deeper global alliances.
Well, I mean, she made it absolutely clear we're doubling down. So no possible peace agreement is envisaged of any kind here. They've made their position, the British government has made its position absolutely clear. They want Ukraine to fight on until they've completely liberated, their words, the East Ukraine, where the people don't want rule from Kiev. And this is fundamental. She says it's our war. She's right. The British basically provoked this war. The Americans are the most guilty, but we've been very, very guilty. Just remember when we sent our destroyer to provoke the Russians in the Black Sea. She talks about sanctions. Well, that's pretty funny, isn't it? Because what's happening with the sanctions is, in actual fact, it's the West which is going to lose out. The Russian ruble is now back to where it was before the war began, and a whole new international financial architecture is being put together by Sergei Glazyev and the Chinese to get rid of the International Monetary Fund, to crash the Western banking system, and to completely change the way the world does business. She hasn't really picked up on that at all. And of course, when she talks about a Marshall Plan for the Ukraine, she's a free market Tory. Ultimately, if you were going to have what she's talking about, we've got to go back to having a planned economy like in the 1950s when we went to war in Korea to liberate North Korea.
I found that an extraordinary part of
the top rate of tax was 95%.
I mean, it's a much longer speech, just a short extract from it there. But it's almost like the cheek of it. She's talking about, oh, yeah, we're going to replace all those old Soviet weapons with our nice new NATO weapons, obviously, clicking her fingers and making plenty of money. And also this whole, rebuilding after the disaster of Ukraine, almost rubbing her hands, looking forward to all the contracts to rebuild Ukraine.
Yes, and of course the other thing is, if there's going to be that sort of intervention, huge amounts of money spent, it means raising taxes, Liz. You've got to be honest with your middle-class conservative voters. You are going to have to raise your taxes. We're going to have to raise taxes so we can go to war with Russia in the Ukraine.
It seems like
your foreign holidays next year.
It's a classic disaster capitalism. They're rubbing their hands. They're making and selling loads and loads of weapons, and they're also rebuilding these cities. This is one of the things that we've seen time and time again with Iraq, Afghanistan, all these places. The rebuilding of these bombed-out places is a massive money spinner.
Yes, but the problem is for them is that when the war ends, and I hope it will end quite quickly, is that they will be left with the rump Ukraine, which has got no resources really, and the Russians will have all the best bits. And ultimately, that will be a big drain on the EU and on Britain. We are going to be paying our taxes to rebuild the West Ukraine, but the East Ukraine will go its own way and do rather well because the Chinese are lining up to do, because they really do prepare, they really are preparing a Marshall Plan for the developing world. It's really bizarre to hear a Tory MP and Foreign Secretary going on about the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan involves massive government expenditure and very high taxes on wealthy people. And I'm all in favour of it. not to rebuild the Ukraine, to rebuild Britain.
Yeah, but we can't do public toilets, I'm afraid, although we can rebuild Ukraine. Anyway, look, the crux of what she's saying there is she wants to see, and it sounds like the US down in Ramstein in Germany also want to see the Russians pushed out of the Donbass and of Crimea too, back to the old Ukrainian borders. And is that at all realistic?
No. In a word, no. Do you remember there was a German admiral who, on a talk show, said, well, it's obvious that the Russians are going to keep Crimea. Why are we making a fuss? And he had to resign. But we've got plenty of British admirals who believe that we are going to go and have another war in the Crimea like we did in the 1850s, and the Russians are going to be given a jolly good kicking, and, you know, the British Empire's back. But it's just fantasy. Because in actual fact, NATO hasn't got the capacity to fight the Russians in Eastern Europe. Just as the Russians haven't got the capacity to invade the USA from Mexico. It's the tyranny of geography. There's no way whatsoever that NATO can intervene in a constructive way in this conflict. They could be mediating it, because the Zelensky regime is basically their puppet. They could mediate here if they wanted to, but they don't want to. They want ordinary Ukrainians to sacrifice for what is an illusory goal. And, of course, it's also a pointless goal. Why would an ordinary Ukrainian in West Ukraine want to fight to make people in the East Ukraine stay in the Ukraine if they don't want to? Stupid.
Well, one of you lovely listeners, I'm not sure who it was, sent me a terrific item, which we're going to hear now. In fact, it was actually subtitled, which obviously is no good for the radio, so I actually voiced up the subtitles. And this goes back, Martin, to the coup in 2014. And it's a video of a Ukrainian general, a Soviet-era general, who was kept on, his name is Yan Kazimirovich, where he talks about the powers, the forces behind the coup, which I found absolutely amazing and shocking to find that many of the people, I mean, basically it was all run from the United States, the coup. He talks here also about who was actually giving the orders to the Bearcut Riot Police. He, as an army general in Ukraine, knew exactly what was going on. But the most fascinating thing to me was the Zionist and the Masonic connection to all of this, because all these key people who were making decisions around the time of the coup were Freemasons, according to this general. So let's have a listen to my little rough translation of what this Ukrainian general Yan Kazimirovich was saying about the people behind the Maidan coup when the West took over Ukraine. Ukrainian General Yan Kazimirovich in Simferopol, Crimea, on the 7th of March 2014 explains that Zionists and the Freemasonic Mafia now control Ukraine. Mr. Yatsenyuk, Mr. Terechuk, and others like them, I declare it openly, and I know it for a fact, that they are sponsored agents of the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA. Moreover, Mr. Yatsenyuk is the first deputy head of a Masonic lodge in Ukraine. And the head of the Masonic lodge, if somebody doesn't know, is Mr. Pinchuk, a brother-in-law of Mr. Kuchma. And all these lies that took place and all the commands, Mr. Yanukovych is just a puppet in the hands of Mr. Pinchuk, Kuchma and Kravchuk. They're the ones who sold him. They were the ones who gave him commands whether to put forth the Bearcut Riot Police, whether not to put forth the Riot Police, whether to let them storm, whether not to let them storm. And when in the end people were allowed to take up arms, they were despicably betrayed. Primarily, this is the work of Mr. Kravchuk and Mr. Kuchma. This is their work. Because, unknown to most, that Mr. Kuchma, after the so-called victory of the Orange Revolution, he wasn't touched. Thanks to Mr. Pinchuk, the Americans returned him the money. That is, they withdrew the arrest of his accounts, and now he lives a peaceful life. His money was seized. And the fact that after they sold Mr. Yanukovych, I'm not saying that he's good. I'm not his fan. He isn't a woman for me to buy, love him or hate him.
Well, he was not right in many respects, although he indeed remains the legitimate president, whether we want it or not. That's the pre-coup president, whether the stinking Banyurites want it or not. I got tired of listening, hearing. Anybody can insult someone. But first of all, we need to figure out what motivated it. What is the reason? Few people know that Mr. Ashmetov did the main mayhem. Rinat Leonidovich, Mr. Kolomoisky, the head of the World Jewish Congress, Mr. Firtash, and others like them. Kolomoisky, of course, was also behind Zelensky. Initially, it looked like two clans were fighting for a sinecure, how it was in 2005. And now, this is simply the direct occupation of Ukraine by the United States. Through figureheads. I'm not afraid of this. I got nothing to be afraid of. Thank God. Well, I have the strength to stand up for myself. But my spouse has stayed there in Kiev. And not just my spouse. There are very many people who would like to join Russia. Very many people who simply want help from Russia to clean out the Holy Rus from the invasion of a red-brown plague and Americans, Zionists. I'm not anti-Semitic. God forbid, I'm an internationalist. I'm a man brought up in the spirit of Soviet internationalism. But I'm, let the people not confuse, I don't have any hate towards ordinary Jews. They are not to blame for anything. They also suffer from their magnates, the so-called Orthodox Judaic organizations of the Hasidim, in particular the Chabad organization, which rules over all this black feast. Chabad. So let no one accuse me of anti-Semitism. And in the end of it, I can tell you how it said in Odessa, who are the Semites? Do you know? No, tell me. Semites are those who drink before seven. Anti-Semites drink after seven. That's what they say in Odessa. I love Odessa's humour. The real old Odessa's humour. But I hate what's being done. Imagine yourself a scene on the Maidan. Representatives of the great Catholic Church, a Greek Catholic Church, are standing. The representatives of the Savi, which during the war went round and showed to the Germans, this family has children on the front lines, this has children in partisans, and so on and so forth. Also the representatives, in other words Nazi collaborators, of the so-called Kiev pseudo-patriarchate, which Pope of Rome didn't even recognize in his time. Headed by Mikhail Denisenko, who, to this day, calls himself Filaret for some reason, but he's anathemized because of the oath crime and for many other sins to the Mother Church. That's the Masonic, I imagine, he's talking about. So he's trying, already went to a huddle with the right sector in particular, that's Pravi sector, with a fascist organization such as Svoboda. That's a folding screen. Its real name is the Socialist Nationalist Party of Ukraine. Nazi parties. So everyone knows the name Svoboda is just, well, they understand that. They won't be able to enter the political arena if they will go under their real signboard. It's a camouflage. But then they put a law, there's that deputy, Brinhets, I think, I don't remember. I'm not strong in these names, but I know that it's 100% a bill to ban the Moscow Patriarchate, a bill to ban the Russian language in Ukraine, up to criminal prosecution. All of this is the work of the ultra-right, with the support of Americans. Fascists, so to speak. I can't call them anything else. Of world imperialism. That's all. Maybe I didn't say it correctly. I'm not a master to speak. I'm just pent up in me. I'll repeat myself again. It sounds corny. Thanks very much.
So that's a Ukrainian general speaking back in 2014, Martin, Yan Kazimirovich, talking about the wheels within the wheels behind the coup, and also, of course, about his disgust to see the Russian language outlawed in Ukraine.
Yeah, it was extremely provocative. Well, I mean, I obviously there's some detail there which, you know, only he would know. But it's pretty clear that the coup itself was orchestrated. I mean, we had our Lib Dem friend from Tim Kent here the other week saying that there's no evidence that the Americans were involved in the coup. And I just think that's absolutely absurd. I mean, Victoria Nuland boasted that they'd spent $5 billion on changing
dollars,
the government,
yeah, dollars.
Dollars and changing the government in the Ukraine. They boasted about it. So to claim that they had no role in it is just absurd. And of course, Svoboda, Freedom, they were told by the British and American advisers that the National Socialist Party of Ukraine, you need to change your name to Freedom, and then we can fund you.
Yes, well, we'll be looking quite closely at the Nazism and the denazification of Ukraine. This is what the Russians keep talking about. The BBC don't seem to be mentioning that very much, though. But I mean, he again, Martin, he mentioned Ihor Kolomoisky. Saying that this guy is, you know, basically funding a lot of the changes going on over during the coup. And you keep talking about Kolomoisky. Also, our sound engineer Dave Bazanko and his new haircut. He looks a little bit like
He's watching my back now.
I'm not sure he's quite got those Swiss bank accounts that Kolomoisky has. But anyway, I thought I'd have a little look at this, and there's actually quite a good report on him by a guy called Olensky Sorokin from the Kiev Post. He's done a series on Ukrainian oligarchs, and here is his little piece on Kolomoisky.
Igor Kolomoisky, Ukraine's best-known oligarch, has a complicated history with the president. For years, Zelensky's company has produced shows for Kolomoisky's biggest TV channel, OnePlusOne. In 2019, Kolomoisky's media channels gave a big boost to Zelensky's presidential campaign. After Zelensky's victory, Kolomoisky kept up his relationship with the president, nominating over 30 lawmakers to Zelensky's newly established party, and maintaining influence with many of them in parliament. He also backed a new political project, which has 24 lawmakers. The first year of Zelensky's rule was a revival for Kolomoisky. The oligarch was able to secure control over Ukrnafta, a state-owned petroleum producer where he owns a minority stake. In 2020, Ukrnafta was supposed to be cleared of all debt and receive a new independent director. Kolomoisky was able to stall the process and keep a favorable CEO in place. Until recently, Kolomoisky held his grip on another state company, Centrenergo, which controls 15% of Ukraine's energy production. After Zelensky took office, Kolomoisky began milking Centrenergo by selling it overpriced gas and receiving cheap electricity in return. Kolomoisky even helped sack the pro-reform government of Prime Minister Oleksiy Goncharuk, who tried to pry the oligarch's grip from Centrenergo. But in early 2021, Kolomoisky's standing weakened. He reportedly lost his influence on Centrenergo after the government replaced the company's management. Authorities investigate embezzlement at Centrenergo and have searched Kolomoisky's offices in Kiev. One of the oligarch's key associates, Alexander Dubinsky, came under US sanctions and was kicked out of the presidential faction in parliament. Meanwhile, the US continues an investigation of Kolomoisky and his associates, who allegedly bought property in the US with laundered money. The money allegedly came from Privatbank, Kolomoisky's former bank that was nationalized in 2016. The state found a $5.5 billion hole in the bank's ledgers. Authorities allege that the former owners were stealing money from the bank. Kolomoisky denies this. In March, authorities charged several former top managers of Privatbank with embezzlement. Kolomoisky has yet to face charges. The oligarch is banned from entering the US and is being sued by the National Bank and the government-controlled Privatbank in Ukraine, the UK, Israel and Switzerland. The oligarch is expected to soon face charges in Ukraine and the US. Because of Zelensky's history with Kolomoisky, the case against him is seen as a litmus test for a president who said he wants to bring oligarchs down.
Well, that's what he said. What he said and what he did was something very different. A fascinating little insight there into this Ihor Kolomoisky, Martin. He's two things. He's into banking and energy, a sort of Rockefeller-style character, and also apparently prosecutions attempted in the UK and the US using laundered money. He's managed apparently to commit some £5.5 billion worth of, or maybe that's dollars, I'm not sure, £5.5 billion fraud on the bank that was being nationalised by the Ukrainians, apparently.
Yes, and of course he uses this money to finance Zelensky's election campaign, and he also used it to arm the Azov Battalion, which are the neo-Nazi paramilitaries that have been integrated into the Ukrainian armed forces. And also, because of his Israeli citizenship, he's brokered the transfer of weaponry from the IDF to the Nazis in the Ukraine.
That's the Israeli Defense Force.
Yeah.
To the Nazis?
Yes. I mean, basically, politics in the Ukraine has always been dominated by these oligarchs who fall out with each other. You know, Poroshenko and Kolomoisky hate each
other. Surely they're just organised criminal gangsters.
They are organised criminal gangsters. That's exactly what they are. And they're also now, of course, on the gravy train of receiving our taxes to prosecute the war to the outrance, you know, the war to the finish to liberate Crimea from Russia.
But he's the man behind Zelensky. So,
yes.
You know, what does that make Zelensky?
Well, people voted for Zelensky a few years ago because what Kolomoisky wanted to get rid of, would get rid of Poroshenko. And of course, these oligarchs have got lots of dirt on
each
other.
This is the post-coup chocolate guy.
Yeah. And of course, Poroshenko was taking a very hard line. We're definitely going to retake Crimea. We're going to attack the Donbass. And he lost the election to Zelensky because Zelensky said what people, and of course, Kolomoisky pushed Zelensky because he wants power and he wants a cover, a kresha, a roof, as they call it in Russian. And he's basically saying to the people, if you vote for me, we'll try and get a normal life in the Ukraine and we'll settle this business with the Russians so that we're not going to, you know, we're not going to bust a gut trying to, you know, fight a war with Russia. That's idiotic. And that's why people voted for Zelensky. But of course he then, because he's not really in power, Kolomoisky tells him what to do, the CIA tell him what to do, and the far right, the Svoboda, the Azov Battalion, they've basically said if Zelensky tries to negotiate any kind of peace agreement with the Russians, he will end up hanging from a lamppost in Kiev. And that's what they told him. And of course Zelensky, who came out in the Panama Papers, he is himself very independently wealthy. So he's been very well rewarded. In fact, most of his wealth seems to have come into his possession since he was elected. Okay? Think about what that means, people. And of course, at some point, he may be whisked out of the Ukraine. Apparently, there's rumours circulating that he's been given, his family have been given British passports. So he may end up in Britain. But of course, he owns loads of property in Florida, all of which have been basically stolen from the ordinary Ukrainian people since the so-called economic reform of the 1990s. Now, what happened in Russia was that economic reform was rolled back and things were changed in a more positive direction. But the Ukraine is routinely ranked as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And it clearly is. It still is now.
Okay, so let's have a listen to what some of the Ukrainians are saying about what's going on. I think we're going to have a little focus on what's been going on in Mariupol. Now, this is a very important fight down in the south of Ukraine. Martin, basically, it was a kind of isolated city, wasn't it, that was had been surrounded by the Russians and slowly but surely isolated. We've now got something like 3,000 civilians and soldiers inside there, and you were suggesting that possibly some Western soldiers too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mariupol in 2014 voted to leave the Ukraine by a fairly substantial majority. But in the fighting in 2014, the Ukrainian army was able to retake quite a substantial chunk of territory from the breakaway republics, and that included Mariupol.
While this was going on, there was some pressure from within Russia for the Russian army to come in and defend it.
Absolutely, but the Russians,
it's a Russian speaking area.
Yeah, that's right. And the Russians at the time took the view that what was needed was a ceasefire and a negotiation. And they leaned very heavily, they didn't allow the Ukrainian army to completely overrun the breakaway republics.
Donetsk
and Luhansk. But also, you've got to recognise that the people in Donetsk and Luhansk decided to fight back, and they did fight back. They've taken more casualties over this over the last 8 years than the Russian army has taken. Yeah, and they're a much smaller country, and they've only got 30,000 guys in their military, which was, you know, basically created from scratch. And Mariupol was known to be a pro-Russian town that had voted to secede, which is precisely why extremists from the West Ukraine in the Azov battalion were put in place in Mariupol to keep the local population down. And of course, in Russian media, it's all becoming absolutely clear that the civilian casualties in Mariupol are virtually all of them carried out by the Ukrainians. They didn't want the population to leave because they needed them as human shields. And I suspect that the civilians that are down in the Avonstal plant are hostages. And of course,
if there are any, because we have apparently heard on other occasions that the Ukrainian army has said that there are civilians in place.
Well, there's a discussion going on, and Gutierrez said to Putin, can we get a humanitarian corridor to get these civilians out? And Putin said, of course. We want the civilians out of there straight away.
Well, we're going to go
possible.
Straight to that topic.
But, because, of course, the Ukrainians are the ones who don't want them to leave.
Because the BBC this week, I think it was on The World at One, maybe even yesterday, spoke to Alexander Rodnyansky, who's the chief economic advisor to Ukrainian President Zelensky, where he talks to the BBC and explains what's going on with the UN trying to help with this evacuation of the Azovstal plant, where 3,000 either civilians and or Ukrainian soldiers, plus potentially special forces from the West or goodness knows what, maybe mercenaries, etc., are surrounded. And there's a real reluctance, it seems, for them to trust the Russians that they will be treated safely if they surrender.
Well, how is this United Nations visit being considered in Ukraine, and what support, indeed, do they want? Zelensky's economics advisor is Alexander Rodnyansky, and he joins us from Ukraine now. Good afternoon, Mr. Rodnyansky, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start with the point I was just talking to Professor Clark there about, which is that one of the aims of Antonio Guterres is to see if there can be some deal struck in Mariupol. Do you think that's possible? Do you know of talks that are making any progress at all?
Well, that's certainly the main objective. We want to get our people out of there. There's still around 2,000 of our troops, the Azov battalion there, and about 1,000 civilians that we want rescued. And we are obviously concerned that Russia might just want to annihilate all of them with time. So that's one of the main objectives. We can't speak of any successes yet when it comes to these talks, but we're certainly giving it our best.
So there are 3,000 people, 1,000 civilians, 2,000 troops, in the Azovstal steel plant, are there?
Underneath, that's about right. The numbers are about right. Correct.
When I spoke to a Russian supporter of President Putin the other day, an MP, he was saying that every day at 2 o'clock there's a ceasefire because the Russians are keen to allow civilians to be evacuated. Why is it proving so impossible?
Well, that's just blatantly false. It's not true. All the agreements that we had concerning corridors and evacuation, every time the Russian side reneged on these agreements, they started shooting at the civilians. It's highly dangerous for them to come out. There is a high likelihood that the Russian side will try to have revenge on all of our troops and our civilians, just like they did other places in the occupied areas of Ukraine and around Mariupol. As you know, there are mass graves now around Mariupol, and we can't really get to them, and we can only guess what's been happening around these places, given what we've seen around Bucha. So it's just not true. I mean, clearly, if this was true, then we would have rescued our people by now.
So the ceasefire line is a lie?
Of course it's a lie.
And if there was a deal constructed that involved evacuating the civilians but not the troops, would you allow that?
Well, on the one hand, that would already be an improvement because we want to save as many people as we can. On the other hand, we know that, you know, this would spell death for our remaining troops, probably, in all likelihood. Even if the Russian side would lose a lot of their own troops trying to destroy our forces. So ultimately, the objective is to rescue everyone, but we'll see what we can consider.
What do you want from the United Nations?
We want support when it comes to an agreement to rescue our people out of Azovstal, the steel plant. And that's the main objective. We want to get our people out of there and safe and sound. The other objectives, of course, relate to just documenting Russia's war crimes with the UN. And this information has to be collected, prepared and documented carefully.
So that's an old colleague of mine from Southampton. I remember working with her, Sarah Montague, chatting to Alexander Rodnyansky, the chief economic advisor to the Ukrainian President Zelensky, about these 3,000 people who are surrounded in the Azov plant, Martin.
Well, look how weaselly worded it was. It should be obvious that the civilians can go. And when he says that the Russians are shooting our civilians, this is all the evidence that on the Russian media is that the Ukrainians within Mariupol were preventing people leaving the city because they wanted to use them as human shields. And the British guys, that mercenaries which were captured, were saying that we saw people being taken away and shot. That's what they've said to Patrick Lancaster, who's a British journalist who's out there. Now, they may be just saying that to ingratiate themselves with the Russians, but there's plenty of evidence to show, and the Russians have interviewed loads and loads of people from Mariupol, and that the Ukrainians were just shooting them at random because they don't like the Russian civilians in Mariupol. They don't, you know, they've actually regard them as Untermensch. The Azov Battalion is a Nazi formation. And they're saying that everybody's going on about how brilliant they are. They basically, the Russians are saying, you can come out and surrender. That would be the best thing. And what we will do is we will give you fair treatment. And that fair treatment.
Well, they don't trust the Russians, Martin, after right. Bucha, do they?
Well, but Bucha is very interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, the Russian army withdrew 3 days before the so-called bodies were found. And the videos of the bodies show that they've been killed almost, they certainly weren't 3-day-old bodies. So in other words, and we do know that the Azov Battalion and the SBU went into Bucha and they said, we've got it on the record, we're going to deal with saboteurs and traitors. Now, what is actually happening now?
I mean, is somebody that helps distribute Russian food a traitor?
That's right.
No, they're not.
Well, they are if you are from the SBU, the Ukrainian secret police, and the Azov. And of course, they can kill two birds with one stone with this. So they kill local people who they feel have not been sufficiently
Russian collaborators.
Russian collaborators, and that could be anybody who just happened to accept a food package from a Russian soldier. Don't forget, the Russians had withdrawn from Bucha because there was an agreement made between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul that we will withdraw from pressuring Kiev as a goodwill gesture so that we can further talk about what we're going to do. And of course, the Russians have been pushing all the time for civilians to be allowed to leave and get out of the way. So in the Kramatorsk railway station, lots of Russian-speaking civilians from the area went to the railway station to try and get away. The Russians are keen for the civilians to get out the way. They're not going to try and shoot them back in the way that the West is suggesting. And the Russians have been fighting in Syria for 10 years, and you can see their methods. They surround ISIS, or whoever it is they're fighting. They don't storm in there and kill everybody, unlike the Americans at Fallujah. They give them every opportunity to surrender. Now, one of the things that might be agreed is that the Azov Battalion could leave with their weaponry and go back to the West. But I think the Russians are not really keen on that. They'll say, no, you've got to surrender. Those who have not committed any crimes will be given prisoner of war status, and ultimately they will go home. But those who have committed crimes, and there have been plenty of crimes committed, will have to stand trial. I think the Russians are preparing war crimes trials on Ukrainian army people as we speak. And all this stuff about how the Russian army has carried out atrocities, but the Ukrainians haven't done any atrocities at all, that doesn't pass the smell test. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia, and in actual fact, when blood is high, virtually everybody may carry out atrocities. And you can't presume that one side saying, we don't do atrocities, it's only the other people, the evil Russians because they're barbarians. That doesn't pass the smell test.
That's the other thing that doesn't pass the smell test, is not being able to see RT and the Russian point of view of all of this. Anyway, there's another person who's been over in Mariupol, an independent, supposedly anyway, journalist now. He's a former United States Marine Corps soldier or sailor, I suppose. I'm not sure what they are. Marines, anyway. John Mark Dugan. And he was speaking, and I just could not identify who he was actually chatting with. But I found this, his take on what's been going on over in Mariupol, fascinating. It's great to get a real bit of insight from somebody who's seeing things from a different point of view to the London propaganda media.
So this is coming from a nurse that I met with when I was in Mariupol. The Ukrainian army, they came into this intensive care hospital in Mariupol. They stole all the canned food, and then what food was left, like the perishable food, they dumped on the ground and they stepped on it with their boots. And then they stole all the medical supplies and they left. So these people got nothing. Now, the Russian army has been bringing like food and medical supplies, but they're still missing out on a bunch of stuff. The Russian military, they're doing a lot. They've got checkpoints set up all over the place. They're handing out food. I got video on there of them doing it. They're doing as much as they can, right? You remember that theater? They said, oh, the Russians bombed a theater. There were 1,300 civilians inside. But there are no civilians inside. It was all Ukrainian army. There's burnt weapons all over the place inside. There are no civilians in there. They lied about it. And the media in the West is pushing all that BS.
Help us understand what the relationship is between the Chechens and the Russian army. I understood Chechnya and Russia were mortal enemies.
Well, back in the 90s, they were, yeah. But then, dude, Putin came. He fixed everything. And now they're like the best friends. And it was – I heard the most amazing quote from somebody over there. And they said, you know what? You would not believe the joy when you are sitting in a basement – where they've been bombing, and you hear the door open, and you hear a rough voice shout, Allah Akbar. They're like, we knew the Chechens were there. We knew that they were saving us. And just so you know, the Chechens and the Jews, they get along just fine. There is no turmoil between them at all. And it's very strange when you think about it shocked me. Chechnya synagogues. And one of my really good friends is a Jew from Chechnya.
So that's a guy's name is John Mark Dugan. Dougan, ex-United States Marine Corps, who's taken it on himself to go over and find out what's going on over there in Mariupol. Particularly interesting to hear what he's saying about the Chechens, because this is largely Islamic area of the south of Russia. Well, it's south of Russia. And there was, as he said, an enormous, uprisings in Chechnya back in the late 1990s, which have now apparently been sorted out. And they've got Chechen brigades of the Russian army have joined the Russian army. And they are part of the fighting force that's been liberating Mariupol.
Yeah, well, Kadyrov, who is the, president of Chechnya, current president, he was in the 1990s a rebel against Russian rule. And Basically, what happened was that the Chechens had their grievances against Russian rule, and he was one of those that led the uprising against them. And at that stage, he was presented in the Western media as a brave, upstanding Chechen fighter against Russian imperialism, to quote Estella earlier. But of course, ultimately, the West stuck its finger into that and tried to, they infiltrated lots of ISIS type people into Chechnya to make the war go on and on and on and on and on. And ultimately, the Chechens wised up and decided that they would make peace with the Russians and deal with all these foreign fighters that had been infiltrated into Chechnya. And of course, now Kadyrov is, very friendly with Putin, even though, of course, they were on the opposite sides at the beginning in the 90s. And he's taking a very hard line and saying that, you know, the Russians should, you know, not back down here and so on. And, of course, the Chechens have also been used in Syria because of their Islamic connections. They've become a bit like the Gurkha rifles for the British.
So, anyway, now to the interview I did this week with Alex Craner. He's a former hedge fund boss, born in Croatia, now living in Monaco. He wrote the book about Bill Browder, which is exposing the truth behind these Magnitsky acts. Martin, this is a fascinating area, actually, because these have been going for the last decade or so, which the idea is that the West can basically withdraw visas and seize assets of any Russian that's travelling in the West, the Magnitsky legislation. But I asked him about this whole business of denazification, renazification after the Second World War, and denazification by the Russians now, and also, of course, renazification but with the help of the Central Intelligence Agency and Kolomoisky after the 2014 Maidan coup.
The problem of nazification of Ukraine was really much, much greater than we really knew, because obviously, you know, a lot of this wasn't being reported in the West. There have been some good reports and documentaries, but generally they're not widely talked about. And so we know that now that the NATO instructors that were active in Russia, there were like something like 10,000 NATO instructors there, that they trained many, many, many battalions of Ukrainian troops and kind of indoctrinated them in the far right ideology. And the parallels with what has been going on in Germany during the 1930s are very, very interesting, because again, you know, like you had this process that Germany was kept in a state of permanent crisis for two decades, from, you know, between World War One and World War Two. And, you know, what happens is that, you know, like there's low employment, there's, you know, young people find no future. And then you come in with capital from the West and you start building up the heavy industries and the armaments industry. And you also start rearmament process, but it goes along with ideology that then gives attracts young men, because they're deprived of a future, they're deprived of a way to find their affirmation in life. And now you give them this ideology about a great nation, you give them the opportunity to be part of something bigger than themselves, and you know, like you infuse them with this passion for the great nation, you cultivate a certain fanaticism. And all of this was going on in Ukraine, but particularly after the 2014 coup. And the fact that Zelensky is Jewish is not all that relevant. You know, like his political patron, the oligarch Kolomoisky, he's also Jewish. He's basically been the key financier of these Pravi sector and Azov battalions. And these people have pretty much told Zelensky that he's going to do as they tell him, not, you know, like he ran on a platform of making peace with Russians, of normalizing the situation in Ukraine. And they told him, you talk to the breakaway republics, you make peace with them, we're going to kill you. And but we know that both him and the previous president, Petro Poroshenko, were threatened with death if they make peace with the Eastern Ukrainians. So the fact that somebody in that equation is Jewish doesn't really change very much.
Okay, how do you know about those death threats?
Oh, they've been reported. They've been reported, and I don't think they're even controversial. I think it's pretty much accepted, even in many of the Western media, that happened. I don't have it. I couldn't write off the top of my head direct you to a source, but I don't think it's really controversial.
It's got to be taboo. You know, we cannot, in the West, we can't admit to supporting a force of Nazis. I mean, we're talking about many thousands of soldiers here.
Well, I think that it's pretty much the way the leader of the C-14 gang, one of the Nazi paramilitaries in Ukraine, put it. So he gave a press conference a few weeks ago. His name is Yevgen Karas, and he pretty much said the West is training us and arming us because we are the only one that are willing and able to carry out their orders. And he said some really ugly things in the process. He said, like, we enjoy killing, we love to fight, and that's why they like us, and this is why they support us. And he was saying, we have so much weapons, we have more weapons that we know what to do with, and we got more coming, and they're funding us. And, you know, like, that press conference is still somewhere online, and I think that it's been seen by many, many people. And the whole thing is undeniable by now, because there's so much video footage. There's so many of these interviews and statements by these people, because recall that these Nazis, they're not shy about saying explicitly what they're about, what their objectives are, what their philosophy and ideology is. And these, you know, this footage is everywhere, so it's very, very difficult to deny. And then they also, say openly that the West is funding them, that the West is helping them, that, you know, like, American and British and French instructors are training them, and that their objective is to go and fight Russia, and they're, you know, like, they're fighting for the white race, for Ukraine, free of Jews and whatever. Other groups that they, they hate. But, you know, I don't think that's even deniable at this point.
So where do you think this conflict is going? How long do you think it'll last? And will it go nuclear? Or ultimately, could it turn into a third world war, Alex?
Well, I think in a way it already is a third world war. And I think that where it's going from the Russian point of view is, it's going to total victory. So, you know, like, the Russians have set their objectives, and they are, you know, methodically, step by step, executing on the plan. And apparently they're doing it very successfully. The West will try everything to sabotage this, and they will do everything to prolong the conflict, because the West's objective is to weaken Russia, to destabilize Russia, and to ultimately try to regime change it. I don't think that the West is going to be successful with this. And so, you know, many people who observe the situation expect that the NATO will try to pull some kind of a false flag attack that could then galvanize, all the powers that are sitting on the sidelines, you know, basically Germany, Poland, France, all the NATO nations that are unwilling to commit to fighting Russia, that maybe that will galvanize everybody to go and make it into a World War III. Will it go nuclear? I gotta certainly hope not.
That's something we can all echo. Alex Craner there, the author of the book on Bill Browder, The Grand Deception, which you can get from his website. If you want to get the details of how to get the book and you want to hear the full interview, which is about 40 minutes long with Alex Craner, you have to go to our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he talks about various things. I think it might perplex Martin a little bit. He's very concerned about what the Chinese are doing with their lockdowns, but he suggests that perhaps that these lockdowns are a feint, where the Chinese have managed to make an excuse not to be supplying in their from their port cities, the West, so they're cutting off supplies to the West of goods without actually saying that that's what they're doing. They're saying they're doing a lockdown instead, and also potentially preparing their population for an all-out biological war, and basically doing a whole load of drills in case that there is a real biological war in the future. They're taking the prospect of a third world war much more seriously, certainly, than our leaders, potentially. He also talks about this whole idea of a kind of suicide pact by the West for food shortages and famine, and you know, and also driving up energy prices around the world, because this suits a lot of people. That's Alex Craner, fascinating chap. But we'll finish with him tonight, hearing his thoughts about this idea of false flag attacks, because they've been being talked about by the West quite a lot. Would they dare to do something like a false flag nuclear attack in order to draw NATO and many other countries into this fight with Russia in Ukraine?
At the end of every conflict, people have to sit down at a table and draft some kind of an armistice, and everybody has to sign it, and then life goes on. So this is going to happen one way or another. I know that the Russians have planned war crime tribunals for Ukraine, I think, beginning in June. So I think that they are planning to be done with the bulk of the military operations in June. Well, now we've seen after, on Sunday, 24th February, we've seen that we had Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, and Antony Blinken, the State Secretary, visit Vladimir Zelensky, allegedly in Kiev. And then 2 days after this, we've seen military escalations in Moldova and Transnistria. So I think that as they're losing the battle for East Ukraine, the West by proxy is trying to now expand the war to the west of the country, to Moldova and Transnistria. So I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know if the Russians, I'm sure that Russians have prepared their contingencies, but we don't know what they are until we see them. So, I don't also know what happens with the west of Ukraine. You know, the Polish are kind of licking their chops about sending like a peacekeeping mission to the western part of Ukraine, maybe with the view of maybe carving out some of the territory and Lvov for themselves, because, you know, historically that's disputed. So they have some claims on parts of Ukraine. So I don't know. I think that the Russians have planned probably to end their special military operation within June, but these other parts of Ukraine, I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, any student of the September the 11th attacks will know that the Anglo-Zionist Empire rather likes these false flags. Would they dare to do a nuclear one?
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm most afraid of. Would they like to orchestrate one? I think probably yes. Would they be able to pull it off? I don't know. Would the reaction in the world be, because, you know, September 11 took many people unawares. And I think that up until some ways into this pandemic crisis that we've had, many people were still sound asleep. But I think that the pandemic caused a lot of people to question what they really think is going on. And I wonder if, even if they manage to orchestrate some kind of a nuclear false flag, that you wouldn't have a lot of people saying, like, no, that's not the Russians. This is the false flag. So, you know, potentially it could backfire too. You know, it could, you know, maybe you had your best, honestest intentions to galvanize the West to go to war against Russia, but then instead you get blowback. And I don't know if these people are smart enough to realize this, but I'm pretty sure that a good part of the hierarchy that they would have to wield against Russia would be smart enough to realize this. So I think that it's extremely difficult to predict because the system is very complex. I think that a large segment of the population in the West has woken up to, you know, to disbelieve the official narrative. And so, you know, what worked 20 years ago might not work the same way today.
So that's Alex Craner, author of The Grand Deception, about Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Acts, these various bits of legislation, mainly in the US and also in Europe, of course, as well, in Britain, which enable, literally by the flick of a switch, for Russian individuals to have their visas withdrawn, potentially be arrested because they don't have a visa, and also have all their assets seized. So, Martin, what do you make of what he had to say there, particularly about this idea of you know, potential false flag or some sort in order to drag the other nations in to fight the Russians in Ukraine?
Well, by and large, I agree with virtually everything you said there.
The idea here we're talking about is a nuclear explosion blamed on Russia, which is actually put there by the NATO forces.
Well, I think that that false flags are the standard operating procedure of NATO forces. So, for example, the Maidan Square massacre in 2014 was carried out by a murder squad from Georgia. So they weren't locals. They weren't the local fascists who did it. And that implies that NATO was the mastermind behind that massacre. Now, that is false flag. And, of course, as we know, people, regular listeners to the show, will know about Operation Gladio, in the Strategia di Tensione in Italy, the bombing of Bologna railway station, bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969. So false flag is definitely in their armoury, and they use it quite frequently. So they almost kind of pull it out of a hat. This Bucha massacre is brilliant, isn't it? So you go in there, you massacre a load of people who are basically, you're claiming they're pro-Russians, and then you blame the Russians for killing people. And of course it works. You know, lots of people believe that the Russian army
especially
did that.
Once you've cut RT off and no one can see any
that's
other
right,
points of view.
That's right. But I don't think they're going to go for a nuclear false flag. And because the consequences are too dire. The Russians have basically said, if you do a nuclear false flag, we will know it's a nuclear false flag straight away. And our position on nuclear weapons is any first use of nuclear weapons will lead to overwhelming retaliation. Now, I think they won't do the other problem they've got.
See, I mean, a lot of listeners will think, well, no one would be crazy enough to do that. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, well, this is the problem. I mean, Hitler shouldn't have invaded Russia, but he did, didn't he? It's absolutely stupid. He was always bound to lose.
Well, let's be
go.
Frank. I mean, the Americans shouldn't have used nuclear weapons on Japan, but they did.
Yes.
They didn't need to.
No, but I think the real danger is that we do get a nuclear war out of this, but it won't necessarily come through a nuclear false flag. It'll just become through, you know, once we've actually got NATO forces directly engaged with Russian forces, and he mentioned Transnistria there, because the Poles and the Romanians are now moving troops into Moldova to try and retake Transnistria, which is a breakaway republic.
How many Russian troops are in Transnistria?
It's only a few thousand. And the Transnistrians have obviously got their own armed forces, but they're relatively limited.
I think what would happen then is that you'd see the Russian army actually start moving on the ground, and the air force, obviously, actually linking up to cut the Ukrainians off from the Black Sea.
Well, I think that's what they're going to do. But of course, the other thing, I was reading about this earlier, the other thing they can do is they control the Black Sea. They can send military forces in by sea to Transnistria.
Okay, so we're going to hear now, thanks very much to Alex Craner, the longer version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Definitely worth a listen. Alex, one of my favourite commentators, he seems to have Well, he's sceptical about everything. He really wants to see the facts on the ground. And, of course, he's been watching the US and the British, the Anglo-Zionist Empire's attempts to isolate Russia for decades. And being Croatian, he's also very, very familiar with the NATO's destruction of Yugoslavia too. But we're going to hear from Scott Ritter now. Here is where, and this is a bit of a theme today, has been the Ukrainian Nazis. What Scott Ritter had to say about that this week.
This isn't Russia going to war against Nazi Germany. This isn't Russia going to war against Finland. And I use that name on purpose because the Finns should be paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine right now and understand that if they keep pushing for NATO membership, this too could be their future. Yeah, we'll get into that if you want to. But these are Slavs. These are Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. These are brother Slavs. This is almost like a civil war without the hatred on the part of Russia's side. They don't have animosity to the Ukrainian people. They don't have animosity toward the Ukrainian army. So their goal wasn't going in to destroy Ukraine. You destroy the land of an enemy. You preserve the land of a friend. And they view the Ukrainian people as their friends, as their brothers, as their cousins. They have a problem with the government. They have a problem with the military that became a NATO proxy. And they have a huge problem with the neo-Nazi ideology. I mean, I think most Americans, you know, we poo-poo that. We go, ah, come on, they're not real Nazis. They're just a couple of them. It's not a big deal. First of all, there's more than a couple of them, and it is a big deal. Mm. Imagine if you would, you know, being in the U.S. military and someone came up to you and said, well, the American military is a racist organization. Said, no, it isn't. We let everybody in. But what if the KKK had a militia down in Alabama? And overnight, the U.S. government went, well, why don't you guys organize that militia up and we're going to make you a formal, we're going to incorporate you into the U.S. Army intact. The KKK battalion, boom. And then you can become the KKK regiment. You can bring in all your brother KKK guys and you're going to be a unit. And we're going to put you on the border and you're going to represent our country enforcing the border. Now, is the American military a racist military? Yes, indeed, because it has incorporated and tolerated the most racist unit possible. Is the United States of America a racist country? Yes, because we have incorporated and tolerated racist military units intact. We've mainstreamed them. We've legitimized them. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Ukraine has done with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. They've taken Nazi units, they've put them in and made them part of the army, and then they've given them frontline positions of authority on the battlefield. And they've taken their officers and imbued them throughout the Ukrainian military. The Nazis run Ukraine. It's as simple as that. Now, again, people say, well, wait a minute, they're a minority. How can that happen? Well, let's talk about Russian history for a second. You know, there was two groups that emerged from the revolution, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. Mensheviks means small. Bolsheviks mean big. But the reality was the Mensheviks were the biggest party. The Bolsheviks were the smallest party. Why did the Bolsheviks win? Because they were violent. The Bolsheviks came in and they killed, they arrested, they beat up, they used violence to seize control. So a minority took control and defined the entire early years of the Soviet Union. The Nazis are a minority, but they're violent. And they come in and they intimidate. They intimidated Viktor Poroshenko, the president before Zelensky. They told him if he didn't pass their legislation, if he didn't push their legislation through parliament, they would mini-Maidan him, Maidan being the violent revolution that mainstreamed these Nazis in 2014. They actually ransacked his office and threatened to drag him out and run him through the streets. Normally, you call that an insurrection. But that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Zelensky. They told Zelensky that if he signed the Minsk agreements creating a ceasefire, that they would hang him by the neck until dead on the main street of Kiev, the capital. Not this wasn't a secret thing that they did. They made a video and broadcast it. So the Azov battalion, the Nazis, run Ukraine. They run every aspect of Ukraine. This is why Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian nationalist who fought side by side with Adolf Hitler during World War II, whose gunmen were the guys who pulled the trigger on the 30,000 Jews at Babi Yar. His gunmen were the guys who guarded concentration camps. His gunmen were responsible for the deaths of 100,000 Poles and 200,000 Russians, civilians.
He's now the hero of Ukraine. They say, well, it's just nationalism. Really? Well, what if I put up a statue of Adolf Hitler in Germany and said, don't worry about it. I'm not supporting Nazis. It's just German nationalism that I'm supporting. No, it doesn't fly. It doesn't fly with Hitler in Germany. It doesn't fly with Bandera in Ukraine. But they put up a statue. They have a national holiday. He's the national hero. They paint streets after him. They put up monuments to the Waffen SS units where the Ukrainian nationalists fight. They have parades where the Azov Battalion put on Nazi uniforms and march down the street with their hands up in the air. They have swastikas tattooed on their. The Nazis run Ukraine. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah, and we're supporting them, Martin. And that's Scott Ritter there. I'll put a full version of that fascinating interview where he really is, going for it, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good summary of what the problem is.
The Nazis run Ukraine.
Yeah, well, they run.
We're not hearing that on the BBC.
No, well, the thing is that they run the military and security apparatus, and that's crucial. So the politicians know, and of course, they've been given crucial support by Western intelligence services, including MI6. The British Special Forces, trapped in the Azovstal complex, were working with the Nazi battalion. You'd have thought that the British would be training the regular Ukrainian army, and you might be saying to them, well, you need to get rid of these Nazi battalions because it's bad for publicity. But Liz Truss thinks the Azov battalion inside the complex is some kind of freedom fighters for liberty.
But, I mean, it is being played down. But these Nazis, since 2014, have grown and grown in size. Fascinating what Alex was saying about the idea of creating mass poverty. These young people are looking for a future. They've got no future. And then suddenly they join this Nazi movement. I mean, it's almost as if the poverty is a conveyor belt to produce lots of young Nazis.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you haven't got a few, I mean, many young people have left the Ukraine because they don't want to fight. Lots of men of military age ran away.
I'm talking about the last 8-10 years or so.
But of course, because the regular Ukrainian army was a conscript army, they didn't particularly want to fight, and they were not very good because they didn't want to fight. So the Azov battalion wormed their way, and others wormed their way in there and said, well, we do want to fight. And of course, they have been working closely with our intelligence services. And our intelligence services possibly know exactly what happened at Bucha because they told them to do it.
But since 2014, the Maidan coup, they've been having, I suppose, Kolomoisky funded or Western intelligence, dark money funded, massive Nazi rallies over in Ukraine with these kind of mock castles, flaming torches. These Hitlerian rallies, great speeches, that kind of thing. This hasn't really been reported very much. There's one or two, actually, over the last 8 years. I think it was Time magazine did a documentary about it. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But very little reporting of this enormous upsurge in a very real Nazism in Ukraine.
Yes, and the British government's position at the moment is that the Azov battalion, who are locked inside the Azovstal plant, are heroes, and we must support them in any way we possibly can, even though the evidence is overwhelming that they were the ones killing civilians inside Mariupol. And of course, the Russians, you see, the problem for the West is that they can control the narrative in their part of the world, but the Russian population are being given night after night overwhelming evidence that the Ukrainians are beastly fighters and that they use civilians as human shields. And of course, they've pictured them, the Azov battalion people, did selfies of themselves torturing Russian soldiers. And they did that. And they admitted they'd done it. They boasted about it because what they were hoping that the Russian soldiers, when they captured Ukrainian regulars, would do the same to them. And therefore, the Ukrainian regulars would be fearful to surrender to the Russians. But the Russians are trying to make it clear to the Ukrainian regular army that if you surrender, your life will be protected and you will get full laws of war treatment.
Anyway, we're going to say goodbye now to people who are listening on the RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey stream. We've got another 5 minutes here, though. Final item tonight is from it's Mark Musser, who's the author of this book on Nazi ecology, talking about how actually quite a lot of the roots of the whole idea of being green and environmental and ecological were very strong within the Nazi Party?
Everything that we see today, okay, in the environmental movement today, was all presaged by National Socialism. So every aspect to it. Probably the most important aspect that the Nazis gave the environmental movement is what we would call sustainable development. So that they were actually the progenitors of it. So they had all kinds of sustainable development plans for, even after they took over the East, you know, they would conquer Western Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Hitler was going to cover Ukraine with windmills. They had all kinds of master plans, you know, garden cities were going to be designed for all over the, you know, farming communities. Of course, they were going to have an economy.
Well, actually, that's a good thing. It's better than covering it with factories.
Well, they were going to have it be more sustainable. They were going to have factories there too, but it was going to be sustainable because both the capitalists and the communists, according to the Nazis, were so over-industrialized, they were destroying the world. And so we need to have a more sustainable idea of how to do things. And of course, they were blaming the Jews for that too. My book deals with the anti-Semitism was also a part of their views of nature, because the Jews were considered to be anti-nature. So I get into that discussion as well, which is actually the heart of the book. And it deals with why the Holocaust had an environmental connections to it. So it actually made the Holocaust even worse because of its, you look at some of the animalistic things that were going on. Well, it's because they had a very strong views of nature. We need the laws of the jungle. You know, we are going to live according to what nature tells us. And of course, survival of the fittest is what nature teaches us. And so we're going to clean up the world by getting back to the laws of the jungle. So that was sort of their plan. And eugenics was a big part of that plan. You know, they were going to clean up the blood. And of course, along with that, they clean up the land. So they called it blood and soil. So you had a German blood and German land. And you need to bring those things together holistically. They were also big on holistic ideas with the National Socialists. They were trying to get away from the Jewish ideas as separated, separated life, from the world, intellect from the world. They were trying to get away from that stuff. And so they brought about lots of ideas about nature, social Darwinism, this was sort of their primary bread and butter. And then underneath, of course, biology, they looked at basically politics as politically applied biology. I mean, you think about that, okay, that deals with eugenics. And so they were going to emphasize biology, and they were going to clean up the blood. And then, of course, Hitler loved wolves, okay? His favorite animal was the wolf, and he was going to be the very wolf that was going to cull the herd. He was going to clean up the herd. And so you got all kinds of wolf imagery, even from, he liked to be called Uncle Wolf. I mean, that was the name that people gave him. Nazi Germany was the first country in the world to protect wolves. You got the Volkswagen was made at the Wolfsburg place. I think his own secretary was like another head of, like she was Wolf, Ada Wolf or something. I can't remember the name of, she was like Miss Wolf or something. And then, of course, you've got the submarines. They were called the Wolfpack. Okay. And then Hitler called his SS, guys out there, he called them his pack of wolves. And very interesting, when the SS got done with some of the death camps, Sobibor, Treblinka, and that they killed up to, a million, a little bit more than a million people in those two death camps, they planted wolf flowers on top of the Jewish graves after they got done.
So that's Mark Musser there. He's the author of a book called Nazi Ecology, The Oak Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview in the Holocaust. And the blurb on it says that he deconstructs the anti-Semitic historical background of the early German Green Movement of the 19th century, which was absorbed by National Socialism, became the foundation of biological anti-Semitism in the 20th century. So that's him, Martin. This whole idea of we must clean up the land and clean up the blood. Well, this is definitely a Nazi idea, isn't it? And effectively, what he's saying is it's a throwback to pantheism.
Well, the Nazi ideology, of course, did have these elements that he's explaining. I don't think the Nazis called it sustainability, which is actually something which was...
Sustainable development.
Yeah, sustainable development was actually defined by the Brundtland Report in the 1970s. So I don't suppose the Nazis would have used that
I think
that
he
phrase.
Was saying that it was that is the terminology we would now use to describe...
Yes, I know, but I mean, but that creates an elision. The modern green movement has grown out of liberal values. They may be deluded in some of those liberal values, but the idea that they are, you know, the blood and soil idea of nation states and so on, the green movement, the modern green movement, is quintessentially, when it actually acts properly, internationalist in its attitudes.
When he says there that the Nazis were implementing what they call political biology.
Well, everybody claims that what they're doing is justified by biology or economics or something else.
We are now doing this thing, aren't we? Britain and other countries, the United States included, are making designer babies. They're saying, look, this is the sort of thing that we can... They're allowing experiments which will see whether this is possible. We had an item on the BBC this week saying that they're now encouraging this whole idea of having artificial wombs to grow babies in.
Yes, but you will find that many deep greens are completely opposed to that sort of intervention in natural processes. So it's not. I totally take on board that the Nazis had this kind of ideology of greenery, but it's totally. You can't say that the modern Green Party in Bristol are Nazis.
No, I don't think that's what we're saying.
They may be a bit clueless from my point of view as a socialist
about various things.
I don't think so.
I think this is a warning to the green movement not to stray into this Nazi ecology territory. No,
it is possibly, but of course the green movement in Germany, with one probably the most successful in the Western world, is very keen on going to war with Russia.
That's
for some
right. It's bizarre,
reason.
Isn't it? I mean, this is an incredible thing about the Greens, the German Greens, and also, of course, we've now got the Scottish Greens leaning towards nuclear power, for example.
Well,
these are things which have enormous environmental side effects over tens of thousands of years.
Well, the problem for the Greens is when Joschka Fischer became the first Green minister in Germany in the 1990s, he became the foreign minister. He was a 1968 rebel. Founder of the Green Party, became the foreign minister, and the first thing they put on his desk was, we're going to war with Serbia, sign on the dotted line, and he did. And the Greens, like all political parties, when they come to power, they suddenly realise that power is power, and what you said you were going to do before you got there is something completely different.
The other thing, finally, on this energy price hike is that, of course, by bumping up the price of energy, as is happening right now, gas, electricity, fuel... Ah, the nuclear suddenly becomes a bit more viable, doesn't it?
Well, that's certainly being pushed by the British government, isn't it? But it's no solution to people who are freezing or can't feed themselves right now, is it? Even if they were going to build them. It's ridiculous.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. Also to former Deputy Mayor of Bristol City Council, Labour Party member, ex-councillor for 8 years, and also that's Estella Ticknell, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews, story tips, etc. via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews this week with Alex Craner, the longer interview with Scott Ritter, etc., and story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list, even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Bilderberg.org is the name of the website you have to go to if you want to have a look at my books, that is to say the printed versions or the free versions or the PDF versions you can get there. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. We drop out at 9 o'clock. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators. I think we can say that pretty strongly tonight, who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know, and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable May Day bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 6 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. We'll be right back.
Phyllis and Cole at number 63, Lunch on Kiss.